The lights are on red. We're away.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 264 for Wednesday, March 9th, 2011. My name is Jim Race. I'm here with Jules Cisek, both of us based in California. Good evening, Jules.
Good evening, Jim. How's it going?
Excellent. For all right, Monday. Good. We are recording this on a Monday. Just to kind of get a jump on the week, there's been a it's been funny, Jules. There's been, you think with a break between now and the next series of races coming up, we've got MotoGP on the 20th from Qatar, the week later from Donington with World Superbike. Things would be a little quiet, but they're not. Things have been hotting up in the various communication means on the net and all around the place. It's kind of cool.
It is. Well, there's been, the launch event for Ducati and, mm-hmm. and all the mystery surrounding the clutch at Honda, and so
yes,
lots of good stuff.
Yeah, we're probably gonna have something really, really cool for you guys next week. absolutely, it's gonna be incredible. But for this week, we do have a couple of great interviews. Once again, Mark Brax joins us with his impressions from the ground there during the World Superbike weekend at PI. And I got a really cool interview with somebody I'd wanted to talk to for a while, and somebody whose paths I've crossed with a million times, but never actually met face-to-face, a gentleman by the name of Ed Sorbo. Used to race 250 GP, currently does rider training, and he's a journalist, all sorts of cool stuff. And that was really a fun interview to do, very, very down-to-earth and sort of well, you guys will hear it.
Yeah, I didn't hear it, but I saw Jim's notes that he prepared for the interview, and I'm really looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's going to be badass. We got some cool listener emails. You want to rip through those?
Yeah. So last week we asked everyone. We just kind of stumbled across the whole idea of what if we lose Jerath, which it's still unknown. What round would replace this that round, and then we asked you guys to write in, and we got a lot of answers both on Facebook and in email. The one that came out the most was actually Portimao, which mm-hmm. I understand because I think everybody who's seen racing at that track, whether in real life or on TV, was very impressed, and it is an amazing looking track. So Portimao was up there. Somebody mentioned Russia, which actually is supposed to be coming in 2012 or 2013. I'm not sure, but I know that the photos of the Moscow Raceway actually look like there's construction going on. It's not like the Hungarian round where they maybe bulldozed a field and that was about it.
Sure.
There's actually buildings coming up and stuff like that. So this and that track is going to be used for Formula One as well, obviously. So. It's at Herman Tilke, of course.
I love the way you say that. There is kind of a little bit of minor dread when we think about that. But, he also did the Istanbul circuit, and that thing kicked ass.
I think he did Aragon too, didn't he?
He did, yeah.
It's just how is it that one guy gets to do such a cool job? I mean, think about how cool that is.
Do you remember, I don't know, what was it? Five years back, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
Alan Wilson is also a fantastic and famous racetrack driver, racetrack designer, and is designed Miller. He's designed Barber, a couple of very, very cool racetracks in the U.S. and more than a few internationally. And I remember that I asked the same question, Jules. I'm like, how can that be so cool? And I actually called him on the phone. And I'm like, what do I have to do to be your intern?
When I was a kid, I used to take chalk and draw racetracks, and we'd have little caps that we filled with some wax, and then we'd just like punch him across the track, and that was our motorcycle racing. And I designed some pretty damn good tracks. I mean, they were flat,
yeah,
but they were pretty damn cool. So I mean that's my credential, you know.
This is incredibly funny because, folks, you are hearing exactly how much of road racing geeks we are, literally from out of diapers. I mean, I remember slot cars, and I had like my uncle had this completely badass slot car track, slot car setup. It was like we had this huge foyer at my grandmother's house down in L.A. And massive, like 20 by 30. And it was granite floors. And we would set up this huge, huge road racing course. And it had like three transformers just to power the whole thing.
Nice.
Yeah. It was completely insane.
And did you have the bike version?
No, I didn't have the – you know, Scalextrics has come along in the last few years or maybe even longer than that. But, you know, and I don't have a Scalextrics track. I don't really have anywhere to set it up right now. But – those of you that know what I'm talking about know what I mean. It's essentially a slot car track for motorcycles, but you know they don't lean, and so
they're basically like the little cars, except they have plastic bicycle, a motorcycle on top.
Well, the difference being is they actually have them in full factory colors, which is kind of cool.
Right.
Yeah, we should get a Motopod branded bike, dude. anyway, here we go.
Yeah, so we got through two rounds so far. The other tracks that I mentioned were actually Miller, Barber, Road Atlanta. Now, Barber actually was considered.
Yep. It was considered but never certified.
Yeah. And I think that one of the problems is that it's a very short track.
Yeah, they would need to lengthen it. They need to move a few walls back. There's no doubt that it is a world-class facility. They would just need to make some changes. Road Atlanta would need to do something similar, although length isn't an issue. Miller has excellent, excellent facilities and a great staff, but it doesn't have that look to it yet. They need some flora.
I don't know. I kind of like that crazy barren look with the mountains in the background.
Well, it's like
I know what you're saying, though.
Yeah, it's like Qatar with snow covered mountains in the background.
Yeah, and so. I'm going to admit this, but I actually haven't been to Miller yet. This is going to be my first year. Yeah. I've not been there.
Oh, I guess that's just because I torture you when I'm there.
Exactly. Yeah, you call me up and you're like, hey, guess what I'm doing? But from what I understand is that for the audience, it's not the best. The seating arrangement is not the best. It's like kind of like a one-sided thing. Like you don't get to
– there's no infield.
Yeah, there's no infield. There's no way to like really pick a spot other than the main stands. The other track that was mentioned, which I thought was crazy, was Spa.
Spa-Francorchamps.
Can you imagine motorcycle racing coming back to there with MotoGP bike speeds?
Let's do it with the original Nürburgring.
Yeah, exactly right. Imola was mentioned. Imola, I could kind of see, although you know, it has a such a negative connotation for a lot of the people who've been following the racing because of what happens with Wayne Rainey there.
Yeah.
But it is a good track. I was very happy that nobody mentioned Monza because I abhor that track. Shanghai was mentioned, going back to China. It was one of those tracks where when it got added to the calendar, everybody was like, oh God, not that kind of a track. It was totally designed for Formula One. And yet we had, you know, some really good racing there.
You know, the best race that I can remember from there, the iconic one that sticks in my mind was the rain race where
Olivier Jacques
in the full white. And I mean, it was just pouring, bucketing down. That was well, and the pictures are awesome from that.
Yeah, incredible. That's right. With the two Suzukis, which were doing very well until they crashed from all the rain, I guess. I mean, crashed electronically.
Exactly.
And then Brazil was mentioned, Rio. Interlagos, I don't think, is ever going to be capable of holding a motorcycle race because of the way the track is laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And in India, the JP circuit, which is a Formula One track that's being built, I think, for 2012 also, or 2013. And it could hold a motorcycle race. And that would be an interesting area because that's one part of the world that has never seen either superbikes or obviously MotoGP.
Yeah. The you know me, though. It's like there's the Austin circuit, too, that's getting put together. But I don't think it's all about the question is Indy going to continue? But having all these multiples of races in a single country. Yeah, granted, you know, Europe is a little bit different story because the Italians and Spaniards are bike mad. But it is nice to spread it out. But I've always said that until a circuit is built, and this is so damn true, until this thing's built and they're throwing checkered flags on it, it ain't a race course yet.
Yeah, that's so true. That's so true.
And even if it is built, we'll have to see how long it stays.
Yeah, you never know. So thanks to everyone who wrote in. It was good to hear. Last show, I'd really like to see us either return to Velcom or to Rio, or just add some continents rather than Europe. I mean, most of the writers are European, so it kind of, you know, makes sense. Just like the whole, you know, football soccer thing, right?
Mm-hmm.
But I would love to see the sports reach areas. A great point was made about Brazil, which is that the economy there is starting to pick up, and it would be a great booster
sure.
for the series as well. You know,
I think part of the reason why right now we're seeing besides the fact of the nationalities that are involved in the sport and certainly the teams are mostly based in the EU. Is the cost factor and getting bikes and teams, you know, all over the place. And that, you know, there's been a lot of talk amongst folks and fans and everything, you know, we'll do it a little bit, perhaps, you know, people say more logically, but I can completely, you know, for example, put the US rounds back to back. Well, that doesn't work in the real world. And the big problem is because they scavenge from each other.
It's a saturation.
Sure. And you know, there's a lot of people that can't get, you know, two weekends off in a month. And so if you have it spread out a little bit, people have the opportunity to see both races. So it's a bit important to have those spread out. You know, people have to make their vacation decisions based on, you know, the normal everyday factors of, you know, hi boss, you know, can I take a week off, you know, in May and one in September?
Yeah.
So it's the logistics behind it are actually based on human factors of the spectator fan. So it's something to keep in mind when you're trying to, you know, plan Dorna's rounds for him.
Exactly.
But yeah, it'll be interesting what happens. But on the other hand, you know, Jerez isn't gone yet. So
right. Yeah. We should not be. The rumors surrounding his death have been widely. What's the saying?
They're widely exaggerated.
Exaggerated. Thank you. Okay. Then I absolutely love this quote that Carl Falconer posted on the fan page on Facebook from HRC boss Shuhui Nakamoto.
Well done.
And the quote is, "The Japanese engineers are very happy now. For the last few years, we couldn't win the championship and the engineers felt tired, even though they worked more. I don't think they've always felt they could win, but Casey has arrived now and they think they can win and he has been very good motivation for them. Internally in HRC now the motivation is at a very high level." Wow. What does that say about Danny Pedrosa? You know?
You know, remember, Jules, do you remember what the original source of that was?
MCN.
Okay.
and it's translated probably from Japanese.
Yeah. These quotes, a lot of them we get are selected to incite questions just like you asked. Certainly that particular.
It may even be completely out of context, but the context is pretty clear here that, you know, they're very excited about Casey Stoner is the point.
Absolutely. And right. it certainly has a ring of truth to it. Yeah, I have a feeling Danny's probably not in that quibble mode right now because those guys are basically.
I honestly don't think that Danny is the one as affected. I'm just saying.
Alberto?
Well, yeah, Alberto Puig is not pleased with that quote. But I'm just saying that there's a underlying. If you see, you can read too much of these things, and you can just say, you know, this is just a quote taken, you know, out of context or whatever, or translated poorly or done by MCN, and but you know those guys a couple of weeks ago who were talking about the double clutch, and it turned out that they were really close to accurate to what really happened. We'll save the bulk of this stuff for next week's show, but
sure.
But you know, and then with this cycle news story that we're going to go into later in this show, there is a lot of this stuff going on underneath. So Danny might not be affected, but the fact that they're saying it means that they may be throwing more all their support behind Casey. That's the way I read it. The way I read it was that Casey's their man, the way that, you know, Ducati's going to be counting on Rossi, the way that, you know, well, Suzuki only has one bike, but, you know.
Well, if you look at it, and I totally understand your point, is that to me, and dude, I'm that little guy sitting on your shoulder going, don't listen to all that, is that it's clear Honda have a laser sharp focus on what they're doing this year. They potentially have a foot up on some little bits of technology that may, well, we've seen from testing, and we've got an idea that maybe they've done something very wise for the 2011 season. And there's no doubt that they want to win a championship. The whole cliche of the best season ever is kind of silly to me. I just say it out of jokingness these days, but it could be a hell of a season. And well, it will be. Yeah. No matter what, they all are good. I don't know. I'm like overly objective sometimes, aren't I?
You are, which is great. I'm.
You said your point was exact. You said there's some of these things have a ring to truth of it. Not so far back, we were like, you know, the sport media set folks had just pulled this story out of thin air. Right. Well, they didn't. And it turns out that there is something very interesting going on. The same thing with the cycle news story we're going to talk about in a bit. And in fact, that was a really interesting counterpoint. Or not counterpoint, if you will. It kind of still fit with what we were talking about. When we were talking about last week about Ducati, and that was based on a listener email. And then we got a whole bunch of more information that kind of filled it out for us and gave us some more stuff. But again, there was a little bit of speculation in the story. But Alan Cathcart, who wrote it, is certainly a valid person to take information from. We're getting ahead of ourselves, aren't we?
Yes. Let's give some time to Braxy.
We should give some time to Braxy. What a hoot, man. I love talking to that guy.
I know. Exactly. I can't wait to hear this.
Roll it on. Jim Race here for Motopod with, once again, very stoked to have him back, Mr. Mark Brax from Down Under, just returned last weekend from World Superbike at Phillip Island, and a fantastic weekend it was. How you doing, Mark?
Good, Jim, as yourself. Yeah, it was a fantastic weekend. Well, you can't help but have a good weekend. Well, a week down there, because down there for the testing and everything in between. So, yeah, it was a good time, and just Checker was put his practice performance and testing into action with the two race wins and the pole position and the lap record. So, well, the fastest qualifying record anyway. So, let everybody know that he really means business this year.
Yeah. You know, talk about putting your stamp on it. And, you know, it's one of those things, you know, when we watch testing, we try and maintain an objective attitude and go, well, it's just testing. Who knows how that's going to carry over into race season. But you knew from the testing, you know, and I believe he was fastest in every session. You're like, damn, you know, old guy is going to kick some ass come race day.
Yeah, it was, well, basically all bar one, the first opening test session down there, that was when Ginterly was fastest. But, yeah, he's been on it all the whole time. But it's getting a bit of flack because of now the equal weight rules for Ducati and the four cylinders that they're saying is a bit of an unfair advantage. But that there might be a case for an argument there, but where were the other Ducatis? You know, they were a fair way away when it was all said and done, come the checkered flag time. Checker and the Ducati around there were just in class of his own, like, and watching him without too much traction control and everything, letting his wrist do the work, and he just had that thing working so well.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I actually picked Ginters on my fantasy league as my dark horse, and I thought he was going to be sharp, and damn it.
Yeah, he was – well, I think he sharpened up his crashing capabilities because he launched himself higher than the space shuttle coming out of turn 11. Yeah, it was a big one that forced him out of the second race with what was it, shoulder and knee injuries. I think that was probably lucky to get away with that.
Yeah, no doubt, no doubt. Well, you know, all of a sudden on a huge track, unlike the tight little British circuits that he had sort of grown accustomed to. But let's talk about a couple of other things. For the most part, the race weekend weather-wise went off without a hitch, didn't it?
Started raining Saturday night. I was out at dinner and it just kept on raining all night. Everybody woke up to thinking, oh no, it's another one of those Phillip Island days. And while we're getting to the track, it was flogging down rain. There was pools of water everywhere, puddles and everything. And we're thinking, oh, this doesn't stop. And because that immediately brought to mind what MotoGP is trying to do with change the dates of the event. But there's still, it's Phillip Island. You've only got to look south from Siberia and the next stop's Antarctica. So it doesn't matter what time of year it is, you can still be getting a bit of bad weather there, but luckily it fined up by the end of warm-ups. And so the Aussie Superbikes were there. They had their opening round there as well, and they were on a drying track with the wet. That was an interesting race in itself, the drying track with whoever elected for wet weather tyres against the gamble it took with the dry tyres, and the ones that took the dry tyres paid off, so it set the scene for the rest of the day.
So is that actually Australian Superbike runs in conjunction with the World Superbike Weekend?
Yeah, they had the opening round there last weekend. It was the Superbike Super Sport Pro Stock, which is basically Superstock 1000, and the Superstock 600s for the C&D graders, plus the annual historic racing that they have there with the Forgotten Era bikes from 1980 to 1985, I think they are.
Okay.
And then they also, with that going on, there was just a second round of the Aussie Champs in Tasmania, well, weekend just passed, because they just linked that together, because Tasmania is like just over the water, so it made it nice and close for everybody down there.
Okay, yeah, and I did, that actually came up on my, popped up on my phone on my calendar there, this being Sunday, March 5th, 6th, there was a race this weekend. What's the name of that circuit they ran at?
Simmons Plains down in Tasmania. It's a sub 1 minute lap, so it's gets a bit of criticism, but there's not too many places in Tasmania, and if you build a big racetrack in Tasmania, it'll probably take up the whole place anyway. It's not that big.
Have you been to that course before?
No, not yet. I was going to go this week, but just the way things are working out, I'll have to wait till another year to get down there for that one.
Okay. Back to World Superbike. Race one was, you know, of course, being the first real race that we get, international race of the season, there was a ton of anticipation that came up to it. And qualifying kind of went as we thought it would. I don't think there were any real surprises. But if there was one thing that I was impressed with and something that we don't always see – was the focus and lack of argy-bargy on the first couple of laps. I was surprised at how cool everybody was and nobody got punted off. You don't always see that first race of the year.
True, but I think the people being testing there as well, they get to know the track and each other the 2 days they're out there, because I think there were 2-hour sessions for the Superbike, so everybody could work out who everybody was. And when you look at the field, there's not too many wood ducks in there anymore. They're all, you know, ex-world champions in MotoGP or 250cc's. When you got there, look at the Biaggi's and the Checkers and Melandri in there as well, and all these other guys that are coming through. That just shows you the quality and the racecraft that these guys are learning at an early age, I think. And even, well, saying that, even our Superstock guys, we used to call it, the bash and barge class, when they'd be lucky to get through the first corner. But even they did their races without too much carnage as well.
Yeah.
So maybe they're just learning a bit more and realising that when you've got to pay for the crash damage, it hurts a bit more.
On the other hand, maybe as the field is starting to age,
you don't bounce as well as you used to, but yeah. Speaking of that, I've got to take my hat off to Johnny Ray after what he did at that during the
practice there.
And then to get back on the bike and then have a big crash during Super Pole at turn 12, you don't have little ones there, where he was lucky to not lose his teeth. He bit his lip. He had blood coming from his mouth when the way the helmet hit him and everything, and tumbling into the dirt. And then I think it was a fourth place in the second race that he turned out. Yeah, fourth in the second race.
Yeah.
After he finished, well down in 12th, but he couldn't, in the first race, because he couldn't feel his hands in the end. He'd been battered himself that much. He was all numb in his hands, and he was just going through memory of where they hit the braking marks and everything and how much braking he was putting on.
Yeah, there's no doubt that Johnny actually pulled off something that I shouldn't be a doubter, but I'd kind of written him off for the weekend, considering what happened to him on Tuesday, I think it was, with that crash out in turn three. And I said, you know, that's a hard, hard tumble to recover from. And so, yeah, a tip of the hat indeed.
Yeah, very much so. And the way he did, he is one tough little nut, just the way that I asked him on the, I think after the Super Pole, I said, one question, what part of your body doesn't hurt? And he said, probably my ankles at the moment, because everything else around him was hurting. But the other one that I've got to take my hat off to is Leon Kamea. He's got glandular fever or some affliction that he had during the testing. I remember talking to you about that. I think I said that he threw up in his helmet during one of the sessions.
Lovely.
And he didn't get better the whole week. And to go out there and finish sixth in that second race and just, you know, even I interviewed him on the grid for the local commentary and stuff, and he was just really, he should have been in a bed. And, you know, to get out there and just put all that behind you just shows you what adrenaline can do to the body to block out pain and illness, to just get out there and do the job. And plus, they got the best job in the world anyway, so why wouldn't you want to get out there?
Yeah, you know, Kamier's always kind of been a pale guy anyway. I bet he was probably sheet white when you talked to him on the grid.
Yeah, all week he was just the same, and he just seemed to get worse if it wasn't getting any better. So I haven't heard any confirmation whether he's got the glandular fever, just hopefully it was a very bad virus that he picked up on the plane or something and couldn't shake down there.
You know, I think somebody needs to come up with some racer cure for traveling, because it seems like every year at the beginning of the year when racers go to testing, both GP, World Superbike, frankly, even, you know, the National Series heading off to another country, you get all these guys ended up with food poisoning and sickness from the plane. And, you know, maybe they should just go out and eat dirt during the off season or something, trying to build up their
exactly. They're just too fit. They're not putting any bad things in their body anymore. It's all an artwork of what they eat and what they do.
Yeah, send them to the local mall for, you know, just sit there for like a couple of days and or a school.
Or come out with me for a week.
You know, that, well, we wouldn't want to actually put them under the table. or somebody like Charlie Sheen, no, that would kill them. But yeah, a fantastic race weekend. No doubt that the two guys that finished at the top in both races were no big surprise. And going in, we had a good idea, and talking Superbike here. But certainly props to Chek and Biaggi for that. I think the gentleman that came in third place, Leon was – well, you know, Leon Haslam was a big surprise, because as you and I talked last week or the week before, there were some thoughts that the team hadn't quite coalesced and couldn't quite put the effort forth. And then Leon basically just said, well, screw it. I'm going to put the bike on the grid with myself and on the box and make the team believe in themselves.
Yeah, well, he did, and they were still really struggling with the setup on it. So even after the race, talking to the guys, and it's all to do with the rear end of it, trying to get the balance right. They can basically put whatever rate spring they want to in the bike, and they still get the same. They can overlay the graphs, and they're basically the same. So you can put a light ratio on it, like an 80 or up to 140, even more, and you're still getting the same thing. So there's a real – I could go on with it for about another 10 minutes, but they're battling to find the results, but, and in the end, Haslam's just ridden through them. He said he just had enough of it. And there's a few things happening in the team and just trying to get the thing to work and trying to really decipher what the telemetry's telling them against what the riders are telling them. So that's another thing at the moment. But also, speaking of the BMW, Troy Corser in the second race, he was right up there until the gearbox suffered a malfunction, for want of a better word. That's what caused him to run off the track at turn four. He was right up there, and he's in front of Leon when it happened. So they're getting, when that thing gets sorted and they can get at the drive and get the side grip in it to come off the bumps a bit better, that thing's going to be a real race winner. It's just going to be interesting to see which one's going to get it, Haslam or Corser, because don't write Corser off this year whatsoever. He's as fit as I think he's ever been. And just on and off the track, he's just completely focused on doing the best he can for the BMW and winning a few races. And he's already talking about next year again. So he's no way he's retiring at the end of this year. And he just wants to keep on going with it. So, yeah, the ride he had, like at the end of the race, he was doing 141s, 142s. Like, I think he's gone quicker on a production 250cc bike than that around there. It was just the thing was, gearbox problems, plus he just screwed the tyres trying to catch up with everybody when he dropped back that far. So,
yeah.
I'll probably watch him at Donington. I don't know how much it'll suit the BMW, because that's a pretty tricky, bumpy track too, and the nature of the thing with the off camber and stuff and the bumps through all the car racing and the truck racing they have there. So, I think it's been resurfaced though with a new homologation, so that might help things as well in a month's time.
That's true. And, you know, I think one thing that we got a glimpse of, but we don't really know the full extent of what they can do, especially with the fact that Lascores was out in both races, is the Kawasaki has some – we were hoping that they had some promise, and it looks like, you know, even what Tom did, getting eighth in race one, et cetera, I think they may actually have pulled together a decent package.
Yeah, they will. The Kawasaki, it's got the speed and it's got the getting the lap times, and it's – but basically, they've done a bit of testing, but it's still pretty well straight out of the box. And for the Kawasaki to get to where it is, after all, you know, what it's been accused of and what it's performed like in the last few years with it, just didn't go around the corners. But now they've got something there. And hopefully Chris Vermeulen can get back to full fitness pretty soon, and because he's got a few critics he wants to answer to with his performances on the track, because
sure,
a lot of people have said he's washed up and he won't get back on a bike. But talking to Chris in the brief time he was down there, he's more than determined to go up there and shut a few mouths, and I think he'll do it when the time comes. And between him, Sykes and Lascores pushing each other, and Lascores being the new kid on the superbike after coming off the Supersport, there's going to be a lot of, not tension in there, but there's going to be a lot of competition, to say the least. And that's only going to help Kawasaki themselves. And they've a good mob of blokes. They're all, majority of them are all English, being run by Paul Bird Motorsport and everything. A few Japanese in there, a few guys off the MotoGP concerns and stuff that have turned up. But they're a really happy-go-lucky bunch. And just the nature of the pit at the moment, it's real. Everybody gets on well together, and that can only help the three riders when they're all out there when the season really gets underway.
Yeah, and it's cool that Kawasaki has actually put as much factory effort as they had into that team. You know, and to be honest, at least to me, and I'm imagining you can concur, those are probably three of the most laid-back riders on the World Superbike circuit. It's a kind of a dream team as far as the potential for people to get along.
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Lascores is probably going to use the Latino blood in him to push him along a bit as well, but... Like the majority of the paddocks are all a bunch of laid-back guys. I think the most intense would still have to be Max Biaggi, but that's Max all over. But even saying that, he seems a lot more comfortable and relaxed in a superbike paddock than he ever was in a GP paddock.
Yeah.
I think that just the family atmosphere and what goes through, everybody's, the organisers from Paolo Gibardi, Paolo Flamini all the way down, they actually come and mix with the riders and the teams and the fans and everything.
True. Yep.
With the paddock days, and I think that rubs off on everybody. And I've got to take my hat off to SBK for the access they've given me with this new website as well, because it's just, it's mind-boggling. It's beyond the call of duty in a way, because whatever I ask for, there's nothing's too much trouble. I just want to help, and they can see the benefit of what any exposure is going to give them.
I'm I, like, I, I will concur with you 100%. Dealing with in front is completely different. And God bless you, Dorna, but you are a tough nut to crack sometimes. And in front is awesome. Whatever you want. Yeah.
It's, and I think that's a lot of that's got to do with since Paolo Ciabatti left Ducati and came on as director of FG Sport, because he's brought a fresh approach and he can see the advantages of exposure and what this championship means to people and everything. And I reckon the competition this year, not only in the super bikes, but even the super sport, we haven't even got onto that yet. But the super sports is back to square one, what they always used to be. And except for a few tyre troubles, we could have had a 7-way finish there after 20 odd laps.
Are you providing me with a segue, sir?
Maybe.
All right. Well, okay. Before we hop there, I do want to I want to just chat very briefly about race two, and we will get on to super sport quickly. Race two, the one thing that stuck out of my mind, and I was actually chatting back and forth live with Dennis Noyes while this was going on, was the very, very cool battle, reminiscent of old. You know what I'm talking about between Biaggi and Melandri.
Yeah. Well, there's no love lost between those two.
Yeah.
And but already the press war has already started. It started in December when I interviewed Marco at the Yamaha private test at Phillip Island. And those two are going to be like that, hammer and tongs all year. And it's really good to see two Italians, two X250 world champions, going for it. And Melandri's suffering with a pretty sore shoulder still after his operation. He still hasn't fully recovered from that. And to put that in on the podium in the second race was hats off to him as well. So that's I can't wait to see the rest of these battles continue. It's just going to be so good to watch. It'll be a real war within a war for the championship, I think, because those two are quite capable of winning the championship as well. And if those two start leading the championship, and
Gets
down to the last few races, and it'll be like, mine goes back to a certain race, I think it was in Brazil in about 2004 with the Melandri and Biaggi on the Aprilias, and I've got experience there, and I think the Japanese guy, what's the 1993 world champion, was in amongst that as well, and that was when they were teammates, let alone being on opposing sides of pit boxes these days. It's going to be awesome.
Some of the moves
were just brilliant to watch. And so look, there was like bits of paint on each other's bearings and they came back after the race. So, and the one thing was noticeable that they didn't really congratulate each other at the end of the race when they were both in Parc Fermé together. They were at two very different ends of the Parc Fermé. So that goes well for all the fans out there to say that there's going to be a good battle on for the entire year.
That would be so cool if those two took it down in the end. Do you remember Germany 2007 when the two of them got into a bash up on a qualifying lap?
And
Max's uncle basically tried to rip Marco's head off in the paddock.
Yeah, well, that's set to continue, I think. Then you throw in the other Italian Fabrizio and the Suzuki.
Mm.
That could be a three-way dust up in the Italian camps.
He's too much of a playboy.
Oh, well, he's got his nose. He's a real family man now, everywhere you see him.
Yeah.
And he's like, talking about the playboy, go back to Melandri and his girlfriend.
True.
Oh, gee, we better leave that. It's a family show.
This is not a family show. That's the best part about it.
it was funny how all the cameras were focused in Melandri's pit, even when he wasn't in there during the course of the weekend. So
I can't imagine. She's extremely hot.
Yeah. Well, he's the right size, actually. He's 5 foot two and she's about 6 foot four, so he's got the right eye level, if you know what I mean.
Maybe we should just focus on this part of paddock life. All right. So very cool. Top five in race two was very cool. Check out Biaggi, Melandri, Ray, and Haslam wandering on down through. And Eugene got punted off or punted himself off, I think, in
Himself off with brake fading.
And that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, and from what I understand, false neutrals, some sort of electronic issue with the gearbox.
That was another one making him run on as well. So, that was a bit disappointing for Eugene, but just, you know, it's one of those things. They're full of moving bits and pieces, and sometimes things go awry. But he's really going to I think he'll shine as well when he gets the hang of this. Well, he's got the hang of it now. You can see that in the qualifying and practices. But, you know, like you're looking at any one of six guys that can win a race, maybe more, at any given time.
That is pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right, let's talk about Supersport, because Supersport threw up, at least to me, some surprises. And I have a feeling that you're hedging your bets, because you and I were chatting before the show. And this is funny, because Mark and I were texting back and forth, and we're going through this stuff and talking about things. I'm like, dude, let's just talk on the phone, and we'll do a bit for the show, because I realized at some point that it was actually worthy of picking up for the show. We talked about World Supersport, and the thing that caught my eye, and certainly caught my eye at the end of the race, was the Yamahas that didn't do that well in the testing, and as well in, you know, in QP and whatnot, certainly made a mark in the race.
Oh, the Well, it's good to see the Yamahas back after their little sabbatical last year. Mm-hmm. And what a way to come back and scatter. Like, he's had experience in the AMA. And I think where he learned a lot of his craft that's going to help him well in the 600s is in the FIM Superstock Championship that he raced against the likes of Maxime Berger and a couple of other guys there that used to bash bearings, bash elbows, bash everything, handlebars, the whole lot. And I think the Supersport bike is Supersport class is back to what it used to be in Scasser. And you can even say that Chaz Davies, how unlucky was he with a couple of laps to go? A flat tyre of those Pirellis just self-destructed.
Yeah, let's actually wander down that path, because I've talked to a couple of crew chiefs now, and the we had three riders go out. Davies, remind me who.
4A and 4A.
Yeah. And we haven't seen that in a while. And certainly it's something that, you know, has plagued other manufacturers in the past. And, okay, granted, this is the first race of the year, but you'd really think that Pirelli – let me back up a little bit, Mark. I'm surprised that didn't come out in testing, because some of the guys actually ran race simulations, no?
Yeah, that's true, yeah. Maybe it was just the way the temperature of the day went, the conditions or whatever.
True,
that because they had a few tyres to choose from. It was just strange to see that where they were – I was lucky enough to be right on top, but when the bikes come in and where they were chunking on the sidewall of the top – not the sidewall, but where the extreme side grip is. All three were very similar in the size of the holes, and it was. I've seen it with Dunlop tyres in the past. Like any tyre manufacturers had delaminations at Phillip Island, but maybe they were making the carcass actually too thin. That's the thing I was thinking of, that they're actually causing flats. Because even Josh Waters in the first Superbike race on that immaculate Yoshimura Suzuki, he had a slowly deflating front tyre as well, so he was lucky to finish the race. So there's something, maybe, and the Pirelli, I did a tour for my website on with Giorgio Barbari from Pirelli, and they were boasting about how they had all these all-new compounds and new profiles and everything, and, you know, the start of another golden age for Pirelli. But with the, I suppose, also in race simulation, you're not getting, even though you might be getting faster lap times, you're not pushing the bike as hard, because you haven't got that carrot in front of you, another bike, where you're trying to bring it a bit harder, and with the traction control and all the rest of it, it was just very strange that three tyres could go like that in the space of a couple of laps. But half the field was on that same sort of compound. So maybe it was just the, you know, the casting process and those ones that let them down, because everybody else got home all right.
Yeah, the difference between, say, a 99 or 98% race simulation and a 105% race is much more than six digits.
Well, especially the pace they were keeping at the front with those guys. You know, they were. It was a there was no slowing down for any, but it was a race the whole way. Right. And even Brock Parks was lucky, because he's in about the third or fourth lap. He's not the master cylinder, but the front brake reservoir come adrift.
Oh yeah,
That was flapping around, notice he dropped right back, seeing what was going to be, he dropped about 3 seconds within a couple of laps, trying to figure out what this thing was doing, the reservoir. But then when he realised it wasn't going to explode or get caught up in the front brake or anything, he just went for it, missed out the victory by 9,000ths of a second. I had a chat with him yesterday before he's flying back overseas today with his family, and he was saying that when that thing got on the straight, Scash's thing, he thought it was going to, they were both going to get past him easy, but he said the acceleration of that thing, even with him on board, is unbelievable. He said, I knew that as soon as I crossed the line, I lost the race because of how fast he come past.
Yeah. He did. It seemed like he did not actually need to. In fact, it almost seemed like he was holding back a bit until the end of the race, because it almost seemed like he did not need to actually slipstream or draft pass.
No, and you look at the way Chez Davies fought through the field after a bad start as well.
Mm-hmm.
He got right up there within a short space of time. So, yeah, it was the Yamahas, even though they've had a year off, they've certainly made a way of coming back to it, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, and I don't think that – well, it's nice and romantic to think that that may be the case. These are not the 2009 Yamahas of yore, even though they were in some sense handed down from the previous Yamaha team, the world championship winning team. Other guys in there, of course. And you mentioned Brock Parks. You had a chat with him? You interviewed him for Moto Race Face?
Yeah, I've got a few with him and went around to his place. He's still one of these ones that's trying to download the off the phone onto the computer. So I went around and showed him before he flew out. So there's been a few more logs being thrown up there. And Sam Lowe's got a couple there as well. But speaking of, he came third. Now, what a fast learner he is.
No kidding.
First time at Phillip Island and right there and had a big stack during testing. And manages to come out and lead in the race for a while. Good few laps, I think he was up there leading the race. And I think he's one to watch out. He's British Supersport champion and could be looking at a World Supersport championship within a couple of years, if not
well, this. If you look at that team that they have behind them and the amount of data that they have at that circuit on the Hondas and the fact that he is obviously a very, very talented rider, you kind of knew going in that he was going to be a factor to reckon with.
Yeah, but he made the fatal mistake. Well, not the fatal mistake, but he made a bad mistake on that last lap of leading into NG for the final time.
Yep.
He nearly got away with it, but just you're carrying another couple of blokes behind you and you're losing exit speed because of the tightness you got to take going into that corner to defend your line. You're better off to let him go underneath you than chase him out there. So he'll learn from that. But, yeah, like you said, good team with Sam Lowe's. You got James Ellison. Even though it's a different name with the Bogdanka Honda, it's basically under the same roof with Simon Buckmaster, the XGP rider, looking after it all with Miguel Praha and Davies, Ellison, and who's the fourth one?
Pavel Skopek.
Yeah, that's it, Skopek, the Polish guy. He's bringing a bit of money to the team. And he's doing all right for himself too. He's not too shabby. There's not, you know, there used to be a few wood ducks in there that you knew used to get in by just having the money, but now there's a pretty good spread of talent in there that's not there just because of the money they can bring to the team.
Yeah, I do have to actually give a nod to James Ellison because he had surgery, I think, on Wednesday and managed
the meniscus man we were calling him over the weekend. to go in on the have a big, big high side on the Tuesday. I think it was the Tuesday.
Yep.
Then go into hospital on the Wednesday, and the meniscus is basically what separates your two knee joints to keep them floating together. And he's gone into hospital and had keyhole surgery from three different areas where they just basically cut the meniscus out and leave a bit there, send him on his way again. So he'll never be able to run again because of what it's done to his knee, but he can still ride a motorbike, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's what he was saying.
Yeah, seen him after the race, and he said, oh, he's still got the stitches in, except one particular point. And I said, you're taking them out? And he said, no, I curved him. He got the stitches out by hitting the curb too hard, and the leather, because the leather was really tight on his leg, as you can imagine, being a bit swollen and everything. But, man, these guys are just, I can't believe the pain threshold they got. I don't know if it's even a pain threshold. They just block it out completely.
No,
you can't tell me you can go in and have an operation on your knee and come out and 3 days later you can't feel any. You know, it's not as if nothing's ever happened. You know, mind-boggling.
The bottom line, Mark, is that you and I, and even, you know, we may have done club racing or whatever, but basically, when you look at these guys, we're just pussies.
Well, I've always, if you ever come to Phillip Island during final qualifying of any particular race, you want to go and have a look at these guys from Siberia up over Lukey Heights, and you realize you can't ride. Now they can throw a bike at the speeds they do.
Yeah.
And, yeah, like Chaz Davies throws the thing away at 220 Ks and just gets on another one and goes out. Yeah, that's all right. Nothing happens.
Yeah. Did you happen to brave yourself enough to head into the Hansbury garage and talk to Foray after Supersport?
No, he wasn't anywhere around to be seen. And even if he does go out with an Australian girlfriend, there's still some things he's just done. He's hard to approach at the best of times from a journalistic point of view, if you're right. Okay, but he's not too flash on talking to the journalists and stuff like that. Does what he has to do, and that's it. So, and he didn't, the box, he parked the bike and he was out the back end of his pit box pretty quick into his little donga there to hide and throw a few helmets against the wall, I presume.
How about Gino Ray?
He was okay. He's a really good kid. I've got a lot of time with his father, Dad, Dave. It was a clutch problem that forced him out of the race.
Mm-hmm.
That was in the first, as he reckons he could hear it going on the warm-up lap, but it was too late to do anything about it.
Yeah.
And he went into an operation the next day on last Monday. I believe that everything's okay, where he's had the tendon reattached to his thumb so he could actually bend it again, because he tore it off the joint of the thumb and basically was locked in the position where it got ripped off for the weekend. So he's got a lot of guts, that kid. Hopefully he can get some feedback from the boys in the Park Alga team to get some good setup points, because he's got some good mechanics in where he is at Smart SRT Racing. Is it Smart Racing? Step Racing Team.
Yeah, Step Racing, yeah.
Crimea Moto GP as well. The Royal Family of Crimea is one of the sponsors of it. And I think they'll be just struggling to have all the information that the likes of the Park Alga team have got to call upon. And especially with those riders being able to bounce off each other, Gino Ray's got to talk to Ivanov. And Ivanov's a good kid, but he still hasn't got the speed or what Gino Ree has got. So, but yeah, look out for the little kiddies. I think he's still only 16, though, Gino Ree. He's not old enough to have a drink, 17 or something. So, got a big future in front of him.
Yeah, keep that in mind on Sunday nights when you show up at the track and can you get me a beer, mate?
Yeah, well, he came to the 21st, well, it was a celebration of the SBK's 21st event down there. And the owner of the track put on a lavish affair and he was there, but just drinking the soft drinks and really all he could think about was getting in and getting out of hospital and getting his hand fixed so he can jump back on a motorbike again.
No doubt. All right, Mark, I totally didn't mean to take up this much of your time, but frankly, when you and I get talking, it's pretty easy to go on for days.
Oh, well, as long as people like listening to it, I suppose. That's fine.
Get them off.
Exactly.
All right, brother. Listen, motorraceface.com, you're getting that together. Things are moving along.
Yeah, but slowly but surely, you know what it's like. There's no such thing as an overnight sensation. I could come out with all the cliches, rain wasn't built in a day and all that, but it's just going to take time. But just bonuses on the weekend of Troy Corse and Brock Parks. They're going to have the name on the advisor all year to show.
Oh, nice.
Yeah,
well done.
And that's free of charge as well. So that was a pretty humbling moment for me when they said they'd do that for me and believe in the concept of it all. So it's going to take a bit of time, Jim, but spread the word. And we've had a bit of glitches at the moment with getting our service up to speed, but I think from about the next 5 minutes, I'll be loading up another 100 blogs.
Well done.
Go from there.
All right. Well, can you get a Sam Corser, photo shoot?
I might be able to, yeah. We'll see what happens. I got up for me the other night, actually, after at the party. I got up and played harmonica and surprised everybody. So I had more cameras on me then than I've had in my life.
Yeah, those two know how to enjoy the after party, do they not?
Right, there's a lot of them know how to enjoy the after party, that's for sure.
This might be an angle for you, brother. You should think about this. After party reporting. All right, thanks again, Mark. Mark Brax from down under motorraceface.com, and I totally appreciate you coming on as usual. And we might as well keep this up all year. It could be fun.
No worries, Jim. Yeah, more than happy to do it. As long as people keep listening, I'll keep talking to you.
Right on, brother. All right, we'll talk to you soon.
Cheers, mate. See you, mate. Bye-bye.
Bye. All right. Well, once again, and I think this may continue if you guys are enjoying it. I know I am. Thank you so much to Mark Brax for joining us. And it sounds like his website, motorraceface.com, is getting off the ground. And I don't know. There's something cheerful and charming about him talking to him. And it seems like he's kind of really digging talking to us, too. So I hope it goes forward.
Cool. Yeah. Yep. I love having him on the show.
All right, folks, so you're going to get a double dose of interviews here. We're actually going to bring you straight into the interview that I did with Ed Sorbo. And I give enough of an introduction in there, and I'll actually have plenty in the show notes to give you guys some idea. But he's a very cool cat. And one of the, I love talking a little bit of historical stuff. He's not that old. Don't take it anyway, Ed. I think you guys will dig it, and feel free to send us any questions, and I'll pass them on to Ed. Maybe we'll get some more info. So let's fire into that one, Jules.
Cool.
Hello, this is Jim Race for Motopod. On the line with me, I have Ed Sorbo. Some of you may remember that name, and why might you? Well, he is a former racer in AMA 250 GP, but also all around the club racing community. Currently is running a racer training school, as well as now the new proprietor of Linneman Engineering. How are you doing, Ed?
I'm doing great, Jim. How about you?
I'm doing great, and I'm really looking forward to this because it pulls me back a little bit into my own past. Our paths have crossed, although we've never met, we may have met, but I don't remember. But I just kind of wanted to give you, you know, talk to you and get an idea. And you have it's always a kind of a cliched term, but you have been around. One of the things that in doing my research that I read, and it astounded me, and it's a perfect little tagline, is you said, I have raced 72 different motorcycles so far and ridden on 51 different tracks around the world. I love that. It's such the perfect encompassing thing. That many bikes, that many tracks, without branching out too far. Give me an idea of what that means to you.
It came about because of the way we raced in Hawaii. The community, road racing community in Hawaii was so small, and that's where I started racing in 1984. At our lowest point, we had four entries for a weekend of racing, a day of racing once. And at our highest point, we probably had 50 entries. So if you wanted everybody to keep racing, you had to help each other out. And one of the ways that happened is the faster guys would ride the other people's bikes and help them with setup stuff. And so, and since I was teaching a racing school there, I ended up riding a lot of people different bikes. And that led to racing different bikes. And I kept the list of the bikes I raced. The number of bikes I've ridden on tracks and the different kinds of bikes, I don't know, would be probably at least 1,000 by now. And it's hugely beneficial to my learning skills, of course, you know, to ride all kinds of different bikes. And sure. Then all the different tracks came about because my friends and I, you know, we were the four fast guys in Hawaii, and we wanted to do mainland racing, but it's, you know, wickedly expensive. And we discovered we were endurance racing. And then on top of that, the 24 hours of Willow Springs. We could ship one motorcycle and all of us fly over and ride this one bike, you know, way less cost and get lots and lots of track time because it was 24 hours long. And that was my first mainland race back in 86.
Frankly, the WIRA 24-hour races are some extreme classics, and they had some awesome guys that were out there running those.
Yeah, some of the greats of all time, you know, and endurance racing, and I tell my clients this all the time, is the best form of training that you can possibly find. You stay on the bike, you keep riding, you know, you try to ride consistently, and you try to make sure you have a undamaged bike to hand off to your teammate at the end of your set scheduled session. And a lot of times people discover that they went faster while they were trying to ride carefully than they've ever gone before because they relax, there's no pressure on, and they start to execute everything a lot better.
You absolutely just echoed something I've said on the show many times before, because the races that I remember that I realized that I probably couldn't catch up to the person in front of me, and I had a safe lead amongst people behind, I would say, okay, I'll cruise around. Next thing you know, you get back into the pits after the race, and you look at your lap times. You're like, oh, I went 2.5 seconds a lap faster.
Yep. Of course, you and I are telling people how old we are with that statement, right? Because now you look at your onboard timer, and you know right away how faster or slower you went. So, yeah. You know, but the same truth is still there. If you just focus on riding smart, you go faster. If you try to go fast, that always makes you slow.
And that statement is so very true. So, dropping all the way back, you raced in what is now kind of a defunct organization, Hawaii, and the absolutely lamentable loss of Hawaii Raceway Park. And even the pictures that I've seen from there, how they tore up the pavement to keep anybody off it, are just heartbreaking.
I hate you for making me think of that picture again.
Sorry.
You know, we worked so hard at that place. You know, it was really a community of racers, right? We would go out and have regular maintenance parties at the track. And you see this at clubs around the nation, right? Making the track safer and this, that, whatever, fixing, you know, the bathrooms, painting things, all that kind of stuff. That's what makes club racing so good. And then, of course, endurance racing, you know, and even more of the same thing where people try to help each other out. And what a paradise to go racing in. You know, we were a stone's throw from the beach. Although, you know, the gearhead guys, we really weren't that much into going to the beach. But the track was, it was inexpensive to race there. When I started racing, entry fee was $35. When I left in the beginning of 98, entry was $60 for the first class, $15 for each extra class. And each class included 4 10-lap races per day. So if you did a main class for $60 plus $15 more dollars, so $60, $75, right? You got 8 10-lap races plus practice.
That's practically endurance racing. You know, I remember some of the Hawaiian contingent that actually came over to race AFM as well. And I remember they had a box van parked somewhere down in the South Bay with a bunch of bikes in it. And they would fly over for the
Pineapple Mafia.
Yeah, Kim Nakashima and a couple.
Yep.
Yeah.
Kim is the guy that I sold the club in Hawaii to when I left. When I started racing in 84, it was right at the end of the year. And in December of that year, they had the party and the, you know, the time to elect new officers for the next year. It was the Hawaii Road Race Association. It was a nonprofit. And I was elected president that December. I had done 2 races so far. I was the only fool willing to do it. And after a few years of that, I formed the Team Hawaii Road Race Association, a for-profit racing business, because I figured if I'm doing all this work, maybe I can make some money doing it. And then, of course, the advantage of that was we were able to get cheaper insurance. We were able to get more serious people working for us. We paid people, and the level of the organization went up a whole lot. In fact, a friend of mine just sent me a bunch of files, copies of our newsletter, Island Racer, which was written by Eric Folk and published by Eric Folk. And it was a fantastic newsletter telling everybody what's going on back there and stuff. Those were some great times.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's actually some really cool historical documents, being able to go back and look at those.
Yep, it's real good. Yeah, so all of that stuff, you know, led to leaving there when it was the right time for me, and coming over here and racing professionally for 6 years and making a living doing that, just being an AMA privateer. And to give you an idea of the skill level that little track produced, short course there was 3/4 mile per lap with 6 turns. Long course was 1 1/3. All the guys who came over from Hawaii, as you saw, rode good. They're especially good on the brakes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I went around the nation and made a living, and the guys, the Pineapple Mafia guys, went to one of the toughest tracks in the nation, Infineon, and raced there from Hawaii and did well right from the beginning. You know, they understood how to set their bikes up because they had, you know, help and training from the other fast guys in Hawaii, and they were organized. Otherwise, they couldn't have got it together to come over. You know, it's a lot of extra work to have your bikes far away from where you live and fly there and all that stuff. And then they could also ride well and not fall down too often. Although, at Kim Nakashima, when he crashes, he doesn't mess around.
I hope he hears this. I know that there are AFM guys like Stanton and whatnot that listen to this. I'm sure the word will get back. So, Kim?
Well, since we're picking on Kim, I'll tell you his favorite story. The first time I met him, he was laying on the ground at the end of the drag strip, part of the track you weren't supposed to be on. We were running short course in a school, and he went down to the end of the drag strip to practice wheelies. And he wheelied over backwards and broke his ankle. So we had the red flag and go down there and take care of him. So I, you know, get out of the truck when I get there, and this guy laying on the ground, Kim Nakashima, he's just some punky street kid at the time, right? And that was the first time we met.
Oh, this is going to be great. This is going to spread.
Yeah.
So, awesome time in Hawaii. And frankly, anybody would be jealous about racing there. Eventually came to the mainland. And how did you end up racing with, you know, Wira, Willow Springs Club? How'd that all come about?
Well, the Wira stuff happened like we talked about. We were trying to, we being my friends in Hawaii, and that would have been me, Eric Phillipson, Bruce Miller, and Morgan Syme back then. We wanted to race, and the cheapest way was Wira endurance racing. And, you know, we went to the first event, and they were super nice and so helpful. In fact, our first time at Willow Springs, the first time we rode on the track was night practice in 1986. Mm. Never been on the track before at all, and it's dark. That was fun.
Was that on the 600?
No, the first time we went to Willow was on a 450 Honda Hawk, CB450T.
Nice.
And that's before the 650 Hawk, the V-twin engine. And this bike had the front end off of a 500 Interceptor on it, so the front rim was wider than the rear rim. And we did the whole race on one set of Michelins. It was a slick of some kind on the front and a high sport on the rear. And we brought the bike home, and the slick went on to Eric Phillipson's 600 Ninja and did two weekends of racing. And the rear high sport went onto the back of a 550 Vision, if you believe anybody ever raced one of those. But it wasn't that bad because it had a GPZ 1100 front end on it, and it did a 4 hour on that tire. So that Hawk was not the fastest bike in the universe. It didn't really wear the tires out.
Let me pause you just for a moment. You had a 450 Hawk with a V4 Interceptor 500 engine in it with a...
No. Just a V4 500 Interceptor front end.
Oh, okay.
We had... Yeah, that would have been a trick bike now. That would have flexed like you can't believe. Yeah, we are nuts.
Go on.
Okay, so then the next year we did a 600 Ninja with the stock 16-inch wheels, and we're the only team to ever finish the 24 Hours of Willow Springs on a stock 600 Ninja. And then we started using Hurricanes, and then we added two teams so we could get extra helpers to come along. And we'd have, you know, eight riders and two bikes, and you still only needed the same amount of crew guys. And in 1990, we ran two bikes, Team Hawaii and Team Hawaii 2, spelled T-O-O, of course. And we finished third overall with the A team, myself, Eric Phillipson, Bruce Miller, and Morgan Syme, and set a world 24-hour mileage record for production class bikes, 2,005 miles, and we finished on the box. We were beat by Valvoline and the Humans on superbikes. And then the B team finished fifth overall. 12th overall and fifth in class. That was the highlight. The next year we did FZR 600s with Honda Hawk swing arms on them. But we bought used bikes, and the engines were a disaster, and we blew up and crashed at every single race we went to in 91, and that was pretty much the end of Team Hawaii.
That's just epic. And knowing what Willow or not, I've never been to one, but I've heard so much and I've seen so many pictures, and I know the characters that were involved, and I know the 24-hour races at a place like Big Willow. Which is just insane. And some of the things that happened down there for people to get bikes set up and, you know, the early quick change apparatus and the Frankenstein bikes that showed up. You were doing that and I was watching a movie in my head while you were explaining it.
Yeah, it was fantastic. You know, a thing that'll blow people's mind about in night racing is that back in the day, let's say 86, the first year we went there, it was much easier at night because there was no light. The city was still, the growth was far away.
Yeah.
And at night, the track was inky black. You couldn't see the surface hardly at all. But the desert was gray. And so it was easy to tell where the edge of the track was. And then now when they had those two 24 hours in, what, 99 and 2000,
mm-hmm.
It was a lot harder, especially in turn 8 and 9, because the city's out there and there's all that light and the ambient light is messing with you. But, yeah, if anybody puts on a 24-hour again in the United States – or Canada, I'll say in North America, I will be one of the participants. And you should come along. It is wicked good fun. And you learn so much. Plus, if you want to find the most reliable, hardest working people in the universe, go to the 24-hour event at 3 a.m., walk around the pits. Everybody who's awake, those are the people you can count on.
Yeah, so I totally understand. I talked to Mark Miller last year during the Magny Cur World Endurance Cup. I've talked to, and speaking of the night racing, I've talked to Eugene Laverty back when he was racing 250 GP about Qatar running at night, and it's a completely different experience.
Yeah, I love it. I love change. I love different experiences. You know, I worked for DMG. I have to love change, right? you know, and one of the things I tell my clients all the time, if you have an opportunity to do something different, race a different track, ride your buddy's bike, do a different kind of event, do it. You cannot help but learn huge things by broadening your horizons. It's definitely the way to go.
And the guys that actually run the endurance series are, you're absolutely right, some of the hardest working people. And frankly, it's one of those things that only the people that are dedicated really get into it.
Oh, yeah, the slackers aren't even going to come near the track for that kind of thing, you know.
not to mention if you volunteer your bike, you're pretty much going, Okay, well, it's going to need to rebuild and everything else after the end.
You know, that was an interesting point, you know, because it was my bike every year. We did all those 24-hour races. And the way that I dealt with that was I put my bike up. And when the race was over and we got back home, if I had $50 worth of motorcycle, I thought to myself, I just made 50 bucks.
Yeah.
You know, I wrote the thing off in my head. It was worth nothing. And if I didn't have that mental approach, right, I couldn't, you know, enjoy letting my friends thrash around on a thing, right? You know, you got to ride the thing as hard as you can.
Yeah.
And that's true for any race bike. It is always worth zero at the start of the race.
That is so true. You know, and when people have talked to me about racing or they're trying to get into it or they're, you know, worrying about finances, well, the finances are the things you actually spend while you're at the track. You need to go to the track knowing that you may come home with a tin can rolled up in a ball. And that's just how it is. When I was teaching for Kegwins, and I was teaching the new racer school, I always said to guys, I said, okay, whatever race budget you have in your head, double it and then hope for the best. Do not go out, buy a brand new bike and try and build it. Find yourself a pre-built bike by somebody else that's been put together well, and just be prepared to spend, but think about it. Budget carefully.
Yep, absolutely. My rule, the way I describe that is that's the inner tube rule. When the first bike that I got for racing only, this was back in Hawaii, cost me $50. It was a 75 CB550F. And I had to buy inner tubes for it. And so I started stuffing all my receipts in this inner tube box. And I was working at the dealership there and buying parts and working after hours. And so at some point the box was full and I added up all the receipts and it was an astronomical amount of money. And I've never since added up the receipts on anybody's bike because it'll make you stop doing it.
It really is painful. All right. So how did you make the step from, WIRA, the rest of the club races, Willow Springs to AMA?
Now that's Bill Wickersham's fault. Bill Wickersham is a friend of mine who had been reading about Team Hawaii in American Road Racing, which was the magazine before Road Racing World. And he got transferred to Hawaii. And so he's like, cool, I get to go hang out with those Team Hawaii guys. So he shows up at my shop with his bike and wants us to do all this work on it. Anyway, when he transferred out of Hawaii and he's flying C5 Galaxies, he's flying through Hawaii regularly. So one day he calls me up and says, hey, I'm going to be there tomorrow. Let's go to dinner. So we go to dinner. And at dinner, he says, you should rent your house to Nancy, this person I had met who was reliable, because I had a really old house that you couldn't rent to some unreliable person. You should rent your house to Nancy. You should teach John's school, John Ulrich. You should coach Chris Ulrich on his 250, and you should race your 250 in the AMA series. And I said, that's a good idea. I think I'll do that. And so I had met this person, Nancy, because I'd gotten another speeding ticket. And rather than pay the fine, I took community service. And I got to work at Bishop Museum. And Nancy was one of the curators there. And working at Bishop Museum was great fun. And I met Nancy, and she needed a place to rent. And she was reliable, so she'd rent my house and take care of it. I called up John. He said, yeah, come on over. Talk to me when you get here. I packed up all my stuff. I flew over. I got a job working for John coordinating his racing school. They hired Michael Martin to teach the school. He had a bigger name than me, of course. And I was coaching Chris on his 250 because we were racing in the same class. And they were paying me by giving Chris's takeoff tires. And that's how I got started doing it. My very first race was Phoenix in 98. I crashed on the third lap of the first practice session going into turn one, and I closed the throttle doing about 100, 110. It had an air leak, which I didn't know about. Never had happened to me in Hawaii. Seized the thing and launched me over the bars and broke my right wrist. I did the race anyway, finished 22nd or 24th with a gigantic swollen up black and blue wrist and headed to Daytona.
Wow.
It was the universe saying to me, are you really sure that you want to do this, Thurlow?
Crashing at PIR. Breaking your wrist, and then the next week, and speaking of the next week being Daytona, you're going to head to the high banks and race. Yeah, you got some.
Well,
and
remember, right? Think about going to Daytona coming from a 3/4 mile per lap track.
Yeah.
The next year, we went back to Phoenix for the last time, thank gosh, and I passed on the outside of the NASCAR turn, you know, with just the hay bale and the wall to take the lead in the heat race, and the start of the race on Sunday. I started in the front row and led 3/4 of the first lap, which was pretty cool. That was only my second year.
PIR, Yeah, right? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that was my 93 TZ250, which I had bought from Rich Oliver's sponsor. So it was Rich's old bike. And in fact, amazing how small the universe is. Last year or maybe a year and a half ago, I was at Jennings working with a guy with a TZ. And this dude came by to ask me some questions and whatever, and I had some time, so I went over to look at his bike for him. It was my old TZ, and he still has the bodywork autographed on one side by Rich and the other side by me.
So how bizarre is that? I mean,
well, in the TZ world, it's not that crazy, right? There's only so many of those bikes, and you know, if you're going to be asking somebody for advice on setting up a TZ, asking a guy who's been racing nationals for a long time, it's not that crazy. You know, and then for me to recognize, it's funny, it took me 10 or 15 minutes to recognize it was my bike. So that was good.
Very bizarre. So run me through, let's just go ahead and I'm going to let you narrate this because I want to hear everything and I'll throw something in if I find something to comment on. But I want to hear about AMA Tour all the way up through the final race at Barber in 2003.
So I had this crazy idea to go do this, and I did, right? It was a classic thing of you got to follow your dream. And it was the right time for me, to move on from Hawaii. I had done everything I could there, and there was someone, Kim Nakashima, to take over the club and to continue it. And I should back up a little bit. Shortly after I started racing in 84, Mike Kaufman was a service manager at the Honda dealership I was working at, and he and I got laid off. And so we teamed up and bought Wheels Hawaii from Gary Kiesels, one of the founders of Hawaii Road Race Association, along with Red Proctor. And we called it Sport Bike Hawaii, the first shop in America that only did sport bikes. And that was in Kaneohe. And the shop still exists. Mike is the sole proprietor now. I sold my part back to him many years ago. And Sport Bike Hawaii is going strong. Sorry, I've kind of lost my track after I started thinking about Hawaii. So I was doing all this stuff in Hawaii, and I'd done everything I could, and it was time to do something else. And the best racing in the world, you know, where you could make money was with the AMA. So that's what I did. It was really the only choice. And I was out of my mind. I had a motorcycle and no spare bodywork, and I went AMA pro racing. Like, I thought, well, I haven't crashed in 2-3 years. I'm not going to crash. I crashed on the third lap. And it was big.
when you first came to the States, where did you base out of?
In my motorhome.
Or at least, the mainland, I'm sorry.
Yeah, in my motor. Okay, so in 91, I bought this used motorhome, and we used it for Team Hawaii to travel around in because we wanted to do the series. You know, we had done so well in 1990. So we had this old piece of junk motorhome that cost $4,000. It was a 76 Dodge Field and Stream 440 engine, just horrible.
Sweet.
And so that was still sitting here. My friend Lenny Kirshner, who we met from, you know, racing over here, he let me keep the motorhome at his auto repair shop, Carol's Auto Repair in San Bernardino, because people would drive by and see it and say, hey, do you work on motorhomes? And, you know, he'd get business. So, I flew over here. I was living in the motorhome, traveling around the country, you know, racing motorcycles. And I really did the thing where I had to earn enough money at this race to get gas to go to the next race. And at one point in 98, I ran out of money halfway between California and Road America. I didn't have enough money to get back either way. And I had a little bit of cash left in my bank account in Hawaii. And I called there and got somebody on the phone who remembered me and convinced them to wire money to a bank in that town. It was Battle, Montana. And that got me enough to get to Road America, and I called John Ulrich and asked him if he could bring cash to pay me at Road America so that I could have enough money to get to the next event. And, that was cool. In fact, Road America was the first AMA event where I made money at, where I finished in the money. That was also the first event I ran on Bridgestone tires. Chris had gotten hurt, was out of the series for a while. I had made friends with the Bridgestone guys. They gave me takeoffs, and I've been a Bridgestone guy ever since.
Let me pause you just for a second. When you were stuck there in Battle, Montana, with no cash on hand, and you're looking at what you've done, bought this $4,000 junker, and you're chasing the dream and chasing cash, frankly, from race to race, that's one of those moments where you've got to kind of go, what the fuck am I thinking?
Actually, I didn't have that at all. I called Catherine, Kirshner, now Catherine Sorbo, Lenny Kirshner's sister, who I met, you know, when I was living over here in the motorhome. I would be living in the motorhome at Lenny's auto repair shop. He'd lock me in at night, right? And she would come by, and I would jump over the fence, and she would give me a ride to somewhere where I could get dinner, so I didn't have to eat TV dinners again or whatever, right? That's how we met. And so, yeah, I called her and thought about it and whatever, and there really wasn't much option. I couldn't make it. With the money I had, I couldn't come back, and I didn't have a job, right? So I kept going. I knew the next morning I would call my bank, and I would find a way to convince them to send me the money. But even before that, I was totally committed. I got off the plane here. I went down the street. I found a trailer place. I bought a trailer that would be big enough to do all this stuff. And then my credit card was maxed. So I called up my credit card company and I told them, hey, I just got this great new job. I'm going to start next week. They're paying me $2,000 a month. Can you up my credit limit? And they said, okay. That was before I even went to the first race, you know? So
how many racers are fully sponsored by MasterCard and Visa?
it's unbelievable. So after the first year, everything was going good. I sold my house in Hawaii. And I sold the motorhome, and I actually, the guy who has that motorhome now takes it to Bonneville and does speed runs, you know, up there.
Nice.
Yeah. So that thing's a total race motorhome. I bought a new used motorhome from an RV place that now has, it turned over a 250,000 miles late last year. And I bought my 2000 TZ from Bruce Lind, my racing partner, and, you know, I just kept on going. What the thing that financed it for me was Bruce Lind and his friends would send their bikes with me to all the events. These are all guys that had regular jobs. Like Bruce is an executive or was an executive at Boeing. He's retired now. And so he had money, but he didn't have time, right? So there's a reliable person to take their bikes to the track and set up the pit for them and get their bikes through tech the day before they fly in and then tear everything down afterwards and show up at the next round. They were happy to pay me to take their bikes around. So that's what made it possible for me. I had as many as 5 250 TVs in my trailer at various races.
Were you driving? And I remember, like, I don't know, it was 3, 4, 5 years back driving the truck when it disappeared. I want to say Vegas, but I can't remember where it was.
Oh, that's Bruce's rig. And it got stolen in Vegas and got recovered. Bruce is doing USGPRU stuff now. But no, my rig was never stolen. I lived in my motorhome. I carried a gun. I had the thing locked up. I never left it anywhere unattended and such.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, you mentioned the thing driving, right? I came over from Hawaii, right? I mean, what's the farthest you can drive? An hour is like a long, long time, right? And my first day, okay, go to Phoenix, no problem from here, right? And then to Daytona, it took forever, dude, forever. I could have put monkeys in front of typewriters, and they could have typed the complete works of Shakespeare in the amount of time it took me to drive to Daytona. It was mind-boggling. But gas was a 76 cents a gallon in Texas that year, so it wasn't so bad.
Let's not talk about gas prices right now. so that takes you through.
Yeah. So then it was just the more of the same every year, right? I got a little bit better at it all the time. My friend Bill Wickersham would fly into a lot of the races on his own dime and crew for me and help me, and we kept moving forward. I met Jim Lindemann for the first time in '98. And he was helping me get my stuff figured out, right? You know, I was fast and all, but I didn't know a fraction of what I know now. You know, I had to learn about spring rates and all kinds of stuff. And so we just kept getting faster and moving along and moving along and moving up. And the last year, 2003, I finished third at Road Atlanta, my one and only AMA national podium, which is always nice to say, yeah, I only have one. How many do you have? You know, if somebody's giving you lip. The last race at Barber, that was a heartbreaker. You know, I was upset. I was happy. It was unbelievable. The best thing about that was we were all trying to decide what to do, you know, for the last race, right? And people had all these crazy ideas. And I'm pretty proud I came up with what we actually did, which was everybody take a really slow cool down lap, like 5 miles an hour slow, and wave into everybody and all that stuff. Unfortunately, we forgot to tell Rich. So he comes smoking around carrying the flag and almost took a couple guys out. And then we all went to the podium and we had our stands waiting. We lined up all the bikes at the podium in front and then we just waited there while they did the regular podium thing. And then we all went up on the podium for pictures and stuff like that. And it was really cool. And of course there were lots of people for that race because all the 250 guys came out of the woodwork, you know, knowing it was the last race. Yeah. And
if you remember, I think it was a month or two ago that I posted a podium picture.
Yeah, on Facebook. Yeah.
Yeah.
By that time, my nickname was the mayor because I was always trying to help organize stuff and trying to get us all pitted together and stuff like that. And also I was on the AMA advisory board for a number of years. And one of the things I'm happiest about was in the last year, I convinced the AMA, look, let's use timed, what do you call it? Time qualifying to make the grids, yep. But let's not have a cutoff. As long as there's, let everybody in up to 40 or whatever their max number is going to be, none of us will complain about passing bark markers. We'd rather have a big field than to have, no slow guys on the track. And, of course, if you're on the 250 and you can't pass somebody who's going slower than you, go somewhere else, right? The bikes can go anywhere you want them to do. And that worked out great. And Laguna and Barber and a couple other places, we had nearly full fields because of that. I was really happy about that.
Yeah, I actually corner worked at Laguna in turn two, on the inside, probably about 50 yards up. And I remember watching that 250 GP race with a heavy heart because I'm an old two-stroke head, RZs, RDs, all that stuff. And I'm like, ah, oh, man, this is it. And in a strange way, I've kind of had the same thing about GP, but I digress. Continue, sir.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that because at the time I was pretty unhappy with the AMA. They ruined my life, right?
Yeah.
Except the result of that was that, I got a more regular job. I took a full-time job working for Team Hammer. And, I was crew chiefing for Chris. But that regular job allowed me to get a mortgage and get a house. And now I have this really cool house, out in the boonies. And I can ride my dirt bike from my house and go up into the hills. And I have a place to work on my race bikes and stuff like that. And I'm still racing, not for a living and not as much as I'd like to, but it's still there. I'll be racing, for a long time to come. In fact, when I win my next motorcycle race, I will have won races in four consecutive decades. And I don't intend to quit until I've won in five consecutive decades.
or not. You might just say, oh, well, I'll go for six.
that could happen too. Yeah. So it's amazing, right? It changes is constant. And usually even the ones you don't think are so good, you usually have a silver lining. So the experience, I've been a mechanic all my life. The experience of doing my own program and all led directly into doing crew chief type work. And I worked with Chris Ulrich for 3 years, and I got to say, I'm so proud to see him doing so well now. He's one of the rare ones, lucky ones, where getting married and then having kids made him faster. And it's just really neat to see him doing so well. When I stopped doing that after the 3 years, there was a big dealership that kept offering me more and more and more money to be a service manager for them. And finally, it was crazy money, the most I've ever made by far, so I took the deal. And that lasted for a year and a half, and I did a good job as a service manager, and the money was great, and I got all out of debt and everything, but, I had to get back to this. So, it worked out that we parted ways, and I started doing adventure racing as a personal coaching and crew chiefing thing, and, that's just been super fun and easy for me to do because, it's just what I think about all the time, and it's easy to find clients. It's been working out really well, and then that led to buying Lindemann Engineering from Jim. And, it just keeps, I like to describe it as a snowball going uphill, and it's a positive thing, building momentum.
Well, let me back you up again. Let's talk about, and I should mention that my stint as a service manager for a dealership lasted almost exactly the same length of time.
I hope it wasn't the same shop, but we won't say the names.
No. This was up in Northern California, and as many dealerships are, this one is no longer exists. But your adventure racing that you're doing, and you're doing very well with it, and I think it's very cool. And we'll have a link in the show notes for this, so you guys can check it out. We talked pre-show, and you have trained some of the people that I formerly raced against, and I thought that was very cool. And I think part of the reason you might be doing so well, Ed, is because your rates are fantastic. I mean, they're good. If I was still racing right now, I'd be like, oh, hell yes.
You're right. And I thought a long time and I struggled with what to figure out on the rate. And I got to thank some of the other people who are doing similar work to me, like Ken Hill. They were happy to tell me their rates and stuff. And it's kind of a philosophy of mine overall is really how I came up with the $200 a day fee plus travel expenses, is that I want to get every penny you have that you're going to spend on motorcycling for the rest of your life. I don't want to just smell the $500 that's in your pocket now and charge you $500 for this little widget and get that from you and be happy today. I want you as a lifetime customer. So if I charge you a lower rate, and I know I'm charging too little because the vast majority of my clients give me big tips, they pay me more than I ask for. So I know I'm doing something right. But I know that if we're both all happy at the end of the day, then I'm going to get you back in the future, and that's more valuable to me. And so, and then that led to the $150 per person when I do group people, up to three people. So at the end of the day, I'm making pretty decent money for a day's work at the racetrack riding my motorcycle, you know, and you're happy and I'm happy. And then you call me up in a couple of months and we do it again. And so I just keep getting more and more and more customers. One of the biggest compliments I ever got in an awards banquet, this was back in Hawaii. One of the guys who gets up there to get his trophy and whatever, and he wants to thank Sport Bike Hawaii for sponsoring him and helping him out. And he said, I'm the worst businessman he ever met. I thought that was fantastic. You know, I knew I was doing something right. So, yeah, the fee is really low when you think about the value, right? And most everybody takes a couple seconds off their lap times in one day. And then think about the crashes that you avoid from some of the things that I can teach people. And
no doubt.
The reduced crash damage. I'll give your listeners a freebie right here. Reduce the steering stops on your motorcycle by sticking on lead wheel weights.
Huh.
The reason you reduce the steering stop is when your bike's sliding down the ground on its side, if the front wheel can turn all the way and the front wheel touches the ground, if the front wheel's in front of the bike at the time, the bike can flip.
Ding, that makes absolutely perfect sense.
But if you keep the front wheel away from the ground because the stops are reduced, then you get potentially a lot less damage. Also, the lead's soft, so every time you whack the steering stop, the lead mushes down instead of the steering stop getting bent as badly. And you probably got to keep an eye on them and change them every 6 months, but it's super easy. And so that's one of the things I do, right? So then your bike crashes, and it costs $50 instead of $3,000, and you go, man, that Zorbo guy, he needs to charge more, you know?
No doubt. I will point out to you that there are going to be people that are going to write into us for this show going, why the hell didn't I think of that? That is
you put that in the category of, with why didn't you think of Pet Rocks, my friend? You know, you could have been that guy, you know? And right now there's something else out there just like that. If you could just think of it, it's all good. Yeah, so yeah, I know I'm crazy, but it's working well for me.
It's good crazy. So as the stuff that you were doing is on riding training as well as doing some crew chiefing, you'd worked with folks like Santiago Villa, Peter Lenz, Elena Myers, Daniel Guevara. As I mentioned to you, I had been at Indy for Peter Lenz, and that was a bit of a tough weekend to deal with. But I think the crew chief work that you're doing is actually probably key to you also keeping your finger on the pulse of how to keep that sharp edge in a race weekend situation.
Absolutely. Yeah. You've got to, it's just like you have to race to talk about racing and coach racing and write about racing, any of that stuff, right? You got to be doing it constantly. So I need to race. I need the crew chief at the highest possible level. I need to, you know, work with beginners. I need to work with intermediates and experienced riders. You got to do all that mixed stuff to stay on your toes. You got to keep up with all the latest stuff because the bikes are always changing, and you have to find ways to communicate concepts to new people, experienced people, crazy fast, really good guys. You know, everybody has, you know, most of it figured out, and just a couple little things that they don't quite have right. And when you figure out what they're missing and you can explain that to them, they put that piece of the puzzle in and it all falls together. And that's when they really, you know, improve on their lap times and stuff like that. Yeah. It all works together.
Who do you find are the hardest people to teach? Those with incredible natural talent, and I still believe that it exists, or those that are trying the hardest?
No, I don't. To me, it doesn't have anything to do with that at all. It's their mental outlook on stuff. I'll give you an example. I worked with a guy who you know, was convinced of, you know, thing A, right? And so I go and find evidence that proves thing A is not happening, or it is happening, or whatever, right? And I proved beyond a doubt, okay, you know, you don't need to worry about that anymore. And he won't let it go. He just stays focused on that. Another example of this is people who will argue for their limitations. Hey, let's set up for this right-hand turn on the extreme left side of the track while we're braking so we have as much track as possible when we commit to the corner. Oh, I can't go that close to the edge of the track. Argue for your limitations, and you get to keep them. That's the thing that for me is impossible to overcome. They just won't do it. They've said I can't. So if a person says I can, I want to, I will, I'm trying, then it doesn't matter what their problem is. We can work through it. But if they won't, if they can't, then I'm just stuck.
I should see if I can steal my race bike back that I sold to Celtic Racing and drag it all the way back here to the West Coast, and you could tell me why the hell I could never get rid of Chatter through the carousel at Sears.
Oh, dude, that's why I bought Lindemann Engineering. That was a beautiful segue. Thank you.
Yes, it was.
I everything I rode chattered in turn six at Sears. And you know, I had Jim Stickers on my bike, and he was helping me, but I wouldn't let him have the final say. You know, I would still do what I liked, what I thought was right, what worked for me in most places, and a bike would chatter. And Infineon is one of the greatest racetracks in the universe, and Turn mm-hmm. 6 is maybe the best corner in the whole universe, including all those new planets that we just found orbiting in all those other stars, right? And your bike chatters through the thing. How horrible is that, right? So finally, mm-hmm. I go back there with what bike was it? It was my R6, and I said, Jim, just do whatever you want to do. I'm not going to bounce on it myself. Nothing. I'm going to just trust you. No chatter. Yeah. Now I know what he did, and so I can absolutely fix your bike. But better than that, better than going through all that, why don't you just rent a bike from, say, Feel Like a
Brian
Pro,
Brian
Barlow, okay. And ride that 250 Ninja, and I'll take. D's 250 Ninja out of my trailer, which he lets me use, and in exchange for taking care of his bike for him, and we'll have a little battle. I can take you.
I bet you can.
Now, see, wrong answer. Okay, and that gives me another thing. Okay, you asked me about who's hard to coach, right? Let's turn the question just a little bit. Let's say you want to go up to Pro Racer X and ask him a question, okay? If you walk up to Pro Racer X and say, oh, Mr. Pro Racer X, I'll never be as good as you, but would you please answer this question to me? He's going to think, get lost, little boy. Okay? But if you walk up to Pro Racer X and say, hey, man, how do I go through turn six without chattering? He's either going to tell you to get lost because he's too busy, or he's going to give you some real advice that works for you. And my point is that if you go up to a pro racer and tell him that you're not worthy, then he doesn't want to help you. You have to believe in yourself first. I think I can take you, you say, bring it on, boy.
Here is the slight difference, and I've talked to hundreds and hundreds of road racers over the years. I will talk to almost any guy that's run super bikes and say, okay, you step down to the class that I ran, and I'll give you a run for your money. I talk to somebody like you or Rich Oliver or somebody else that has spent a lot of time on 250s, both two and four stroke, and I know I'm in for a battle, so I'm going to be humble.
Yeah. You know, I tell you something, and I don't know how many people will admit this, but it's true of all the truly fast riders. And you don't have to be at the front to be truly fast, right? Truly fast is a broad definition that includes how you approach the racing, like in a professional manner and all that other stuff, right? I line up on the grid next to Rossi, and I'm on an XR50, and he's on his MotoGP bike, there's a part of my brain that believes I can win this race. And then when it's race time, I just turn that part of my brain on all the way and turn the other part down. If you can't believe in yourself first, then you're never going to be able to commit to the corner and brake hard all the way in and all the other things you've got to do. You know, drive across the country to do it and blah, 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 blah.
Yep.
So, and then furthermore, if we lined up on 250 Ninjas right now, I guarantee you I take him.
That would be
fun. Call him up. Tell him I said it. We'll see if he shows up.
I think he's kind of busy right now.
Well, that's his loss.
That is such an epic lesson and such an important lesson, something, to be honest, that I struggled with. That, and I think part of it was because I felt very committed to my job and my work and my family. I wasn't willing to I was rarely willing to go that extra mile until I got a little bit of red mist that pushed me beyond that. But it was only that would ever push me beyond that. And that was probably why I was never a guy that I never got a podium in AFM 250P. I was always upper mid pack, but there was always a point that I wouldn't push past. And the problem was I knew it. I would know it when I was riding. And remember when I said when I would relax and stop thinking about it is when I went way faster.
Yep, exactly. And of course, and that's a fair thing, right? The people in the situation that I was in or still am in, right? No kids, able to commit completely to racing, right? Mm-hmm. You know, let's say you got kids, right? What more noble purpose is there than to being a good parent? And being a good parent means you've got to be there for the kids. You can't go off and be selfish and get killed and all that kind of stuff, right? There's very few people who can do that. So if you're out in racing world right now and you're going racing and you're thinking, I need to go to work on Monday for all these really good reasons, and therefore I'm going to ride at, 95%, right? I'm not going to ride at 105% and take that chance at all. Good on you, right? That's no hit against you. That's just what you got to do, and that's smart, right? Along with that list of however many bikes I've raced and however many different tracks I've raced on, I've had 34 crashes at the racetrack, not counting street crashes. And, yep. My broken bone list is both wrists twice, both ankles twice, shoulder once, a couple of fingers, and my neck once. You know, that's not all good stuff.
But you know what, though? That is a testament to not-so-modern and modern racing gear. It's amazing if you use the right stuff, how well you can keep yourself together. I guess part of it is that you probably rarely hit immovable objects.
I was incredibly lucky. Now, of course, Hawaii, the track was really slow. And we did a lot of work to keep – and it's not to say that there wasn't stuff you couldn't hit, that you could hit, and people did. But I never hit anything. I never even been into air fence. My injuries all happened when I broke my neck. I was still up in the air. I snapped my head so hard forward that the vertebrae touched each other and cracked them. And then I got run over and things like that, and then the impacts with the ground. But I was fortunate. Leathers were becoming inexpensive and readily available very early. I only raced for a short period of time with inadequate gear. And then, of course, all my fastest racing was done in the modern era with lots of good stuff. And, for sure, it's definitely – and helmets are way, way better than they used to be, too.
Yeah, and about, a quarter as light as back in the day of the big old Bell bowling balls?
Oh, yeah. My helmet being as light as it was probably helped reduce my neck injuries. I'm really looking forward to the airbag thingies that you're seeing now. Deploy when you come off the bike. That would have prevented my neck injury for sure.
Yes, the Dainese stuff that they're coming out with. And I think also I want to say AGV or Alpenstar are also coming out with them. And I think that's very cool. And they took a long time to make sure that was going to work, working at the highest levels with guys in MotoGP with accelerometers and the humps and all that. And while it may be a little bit more expensive, it's kind of like the at brace they're using in Supercross and Motocross to try and, as well as that derived from NASCAR, to try and keep these people's, and well, dude, your neck and your head are the most important things about you. The rest of it can.
Yeah. I want to say something here. I was the owner, president of the club in Hawaii when back protectors started out, and we eventually put in a rule, right, to require back protectors. And I used to have to go out. I would go out on the grid before the warm-up lap and whack everybody in the back to make sure they had them, right? And, yep. And we had to go through the – okay, so fast forward to now, the current new thing is chest protectors. And clubs and organizations need to start requiring chest protectors, and people need to get off their duff, myself included, and get one. They clearly work. They clearly contribute to making your life better, making it safer. And they don't get in the way. They don't cause problems. And if you don't have one, you should get one. You're out of your mind not to have the best – safety gear that you can possibly have when you're riding. And that includes buying a good helmet, not getting the $5 one from wherever, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, part of that thing you talk about chest protectors, I actually think stems from Peter Lenz's accident, I want to say at PR up in Portland. And you remember that he crashed there horribly into turn one when he had a brake failure. And while he had some pretty bad damage to his legs, managed to come back from that simply because of the impact that he took to his chest with, who is it, Safety First that were making those? And I think that's a free ad.
Yeah, that was before I was working with him. I heard that he had a big crash and knew he came back quick. I know he was wearing a chest protector. They clearly, definitely work, and that stuff's all good stuff. And, yeah, the more protection. Now, you think about how vulnerable the front of your body is, right? That's where all the important organs are. And the big thing is it doesn't get in the way, right? So just get one and get going with it. And yes. That's for me too. I got to get one.
Somebody someday needs to come out with a full on motorcycle specific, family jewels protector that works well and is comfortable.
You know, I don't know anybody that's hurt themselves that way, and I never got whacked. I think however we're on our bike, it's reasonably well protected.
I'm just thinking.
I'm not that worried about it. Yeah.
All right, so let's move on a little bit, and I want to talk to you, and all of that's fascinating stuff, and just a reminder, if you come in the middle of this, and it isn't live, but this is Ed Sorbo, I want to talk about your very recent purchase, beginning of February, of Lindemann Engineering, and you kind of explained some of the backstory for me that he started working with you when you were on 250s, but to me, this is a big deal, because on the West Coast, there are just a few people that are top-notch in the road racing suspension field, and one name that has come up for years and years and has multiple AMA championships as well as other disciplines would be one, Jim Lindemann and Lindemann Engineering. How'd that happen?
Well, for me, it started in 98. My forks on my 93 TZ250 had different valving left and right from different year bikes. The pieces had been mixed around before I got the bike. Yeah. And, you know, when I discovered this, I tried to find somebody who could help me with it. And every place I went to, they wanted to sell me their thing, you know, and I had no money. I was living from hand to mouth. So I stumbled across Jim at Willow Springs at the AMA National that weekend. And, you know, he said, well, you know, let me take a look at it. And he looked at it and saw the valving was different. And he goes, well, you know, this one's doing this and that one's doing that. So if I do this to this washer stack and that to the other washer stack, well, then they'll be both working pretty much the same. And, you know, he was the first guy that was willing to, you know, work with the stuff I had. And you know, so that started a relationship. You know, and I noticed at the time that he had a shaved head and he had really cool scars. And I learned later that those were from brain cancer, you know, from surgeries and whatnot. And, you know, every time he worked on my bike, my bike got better. And every time I asked him a question, he explained until I got it, you know, and it made sense to me, which was pretty quick in most cases, but some of his things that he was talking about were way beyond where I was at the time, and it took a bit of explaining and whatnot. And also, he has the girth dyno, and by girth, he means he bounces on your motorcycle and feels what it's doing, right? His girth, his weight, is the dyno. And I get that concept, and I like that. And I know there's people who say, oh, you bounce on the bike, and you can't possibly move it fast enough. You know, when you hit a high-speed bump situation, a sharp-edge bump, you can't bounce on it that quickly. Well, yeah, I can't bounce on it that quickly, but I can feel most of that. And I know that when I bounce on, you know, somebody's bike and it goes boinga, 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 and it should, you know, move a little slower, right? That gets me in the ballpark. So I just gelled with the way Jim thought about things. So that went on through, you know, the end of the AMA 250 stuff through 2003. I ran his stickers. He helped me out. You know, I paid him what I could. And he's an honest guy. I picked that up in him right from the beginning. And then, you know, his health started to get not as good, and it was hard to be at work all day and stuff. And I knew his shop was for sale, and I talked to him about it. But I had no money. So I knew his business was for sale, and I knew it was a great one. And I knew that it gelled with what Adventure Racing was doing, because I was sending my clients to him for work all the time. You know, I'd recognize that they needed different springs or their damping was cuckoo, and they'd send their stuff to Jim on my recommendation. It would come back, the bike would be fantastic, and they would credit me, you know, for telling them about it. So when the shop was for sale, you know, we talked and we came up with a good plan and made a deal, and I got a great business and a great name, and Jim's consulting for me, and Jim's got something to do to keep him busy. I was working on stuff today, and I called him three times in just one day. So it's working fantastic, I think, for both of us. I keep thinking of, you remember when we put Hubble into space and they got it working correctly? And what did we discover? We discovered that there's more stuff out there than we even began to know about, right? Every time I call up Jim, I'm like, oh, I'm going to have to ask him about that next time. You know, he knows so much stuff. It's unbelievable. So, yeah, I talk to Jim and I just keep learning more and more stuff. He's there every time I need him. And it fits out good. You know, it keeps him a little bit involved with racing and whatnot, and it's a huge benefit for me. It's suspension, you know, is hand and fist with riding your motorcycle. So it works perfect with what Adventure Racing is doing. I'm operating the two businesses separately, but obviously they complement each other super well.
Absolutely cool that you've got that back. It's a little bit odd that you've, or at least for those of us in Northern California, we kind of feel a little bit lost because we've lost one of our great suspension tuners. Although I understand that these days with shipping and everything, we can get things down to you. So it's not like it's lost. It's just misplaced. You're down in Redlands now and working out of a shop down there?
Yeah, the location is in Redlands, which is right next door to San Bernardino. Everybody knows where San Bernardino is. And you're totally right about the shipping. It's easy. And, hey, you know, I can travel to any racetrack in North America, and I've ridden on most of them already. So I can come there and do the work. But a fair amount of Jim's work was people driving directly to the shop, but most of it was people shipping the stuff anyway. So it's right. not that much of a difference. I do have to admit that I don't have much experience in dirt bikes, and I'm not doing any dirt bike stuff. So the guys who are calling me with that, I'm having to regretfully refuse that work.
Well, you know, focus on what you know, and frankly, the knowledge you have as a racer to be able to. And especially your track knowledge, and to be able to use that as a reference point for what you think might work best in consultation with Jim Linneman. And yes, he is quite the character. I think it's kind of a big bonus. So going on from here, what are your plans for 2011? I mean, I know you've got the coaching gig, and I think that's very cool. And you know what? I will probably take you up. In fact, I'm going to edit some of that back in, the part we were talking about, Sears and the Challenge.
It's Infineon Raceway.
Dude, I can't change that much.
No, but you have to, and I'll tell you the reason why. So when they first made the change, right, I kind of resisted as well. But then I saw the improvements that they made to the track with the $50 million.
True.
And I crashed in a place where there had been a wall to hit, right? And, okay. you know, friends and the same stuff like that. And so I started calling in Indian. Last year, I was up there racing, and I came across a couple guys who apparently, like you, have a big resistance to making the change. And so my point was then, imagine if we could get a farm company to support Heartland Park and get a few improvements made there to give them some capital so they could build up some fan base, right? We could have another really cool racetrack in the middle of the country in a market that we're not tapping now. So if we want other companies to do what Infineon has done for Infineon Raceway, we need to support Infineon.
But
that's a good reason.
It's a good reason, but then I hearken back because and this will be an interesting philosophical discussion. The big reason it changed is because the company actually changed hands and was run by Speedway Associates, who are the people that own these massive NASCAR tracks across the United States. And so they were able to take the capital that they could make from other tracks and actually use it. And there's no doubt that Sears Point Infineon Raceway
thank you.
from 1999 through 2005. And I raced there during that period. And boy, did we have some unique configurations during that. I remember the one little teeny tiny short circuit we ran while the entire paddock was being redone. It has made some massive safety improvements. And a tip of the hat to them. Turn 10 still needs some work, but you know, you'd have to move a highway for that.
Yeah.
It's a fantastic track. I love it. I've always loved it. I've done the most laps there than anything else. And so I absolutely do applaud them, Steve, everybody there. And I will be back this year for AMA and whatever else comes. But that was the sponsorship name. But really, the people that invested the money in it were the owners of the track. And is that the most politically correct thing to say? No, it doesn't help invite sponsors in. It's just how I feel.
Yeah, but some of that money came from Infineon,
sure.
and it definitely contributed. So that's the reason I will meet you at Infineon Raceway.
Okay, then it's on.
You can meet me at Sears. Cool. So before that, we were saying something about something.
This is classic where I get lost.
How did you ever make it as an announcer, dude?
Because I have a real job where it pays me money.
Yeah, okay. good plan. Yeah. My plans for the future are right now, it looks like a bomb went off in my shop. I still have a bunch of the stuff in the trailer that I use to bring everything down here, you know, and I'm getting organized and getting up to speed and whatnot. I've got so much to learn, and I'm looking forward to it so much that I'm going to focus on adventure and Linneman Engineering this year. I'm actually kind of prefer if I don't get an AMA national gig because that takes away so much time.
Sure.
I'm hoping also to be able to get back to do a little racing myself this year. I want to get that first win in the fourth decade. And also, of course, racing lends credibility to my marketing. You know, it's people are more likely to believe you when you say, look, dude, just close your eyes and keep it wide open, you know, if I can actually do it myself.
Cool.
And then on into the future, you know, I hope to, you know, grow my skills and make it so Linneman Engineering survives forever and keep going with the adventure stuff. You know, just if I could get to where I could be, you know, going to, you know, the really cool tracks around the country, you know, Miller, Barber, VIR, Infineon, you know, once or twice a year, that kind of stuff, maybe make it back up to Mossport in Canada. That would be really cool. So that would be a goal for, you know, growing the business to have enough income and to be able to go do that stuff. And then, of course, for my kind of work, I could be working when I'm at those places as well. So it all ties in nicely.
How cool is that?
It's wicked cool. You know, I think I'm a poster child for, you know, you got to do what you believe in. You got to follow your dream. It sounds corny and all that kind of stuff, but all those decisions I made, you know, to go in to make Sport Bike Hawaii with Mike Kaufman as my partner. And at the time I thought, you know what, I'm going to do this because it'll be the equivalent of college education, right? I mean, I barely graduated high school. And that worked, you know, and then I had an opportunity to race in the mainland with my friends. So I did that. And I had an opportunity to own the racing club, and I did that. And I started a racing school, and all of those things, I didn't know how to do it. I just thought, you know, I'll go try it. And it worked out. And, you know, if you keep your head down and you work hard and you take good notes and you're honest, you can succeed. You know, it really is no limits, you know, in America. You know, maybe in a little while we can go to Egypt and race. How cool would that be?
Yeah, wow. Well, you know, frankly, the amount of, yeah, I mean, and boy, we could head off on a, wow, a racing political discussion, or, for example, the Bahrain circuit that the F1 race was canceled at. Ed, wow, this has been fantastic. I'm going to have to talk to you again. I think there's far more territory that still needs to be covered, but not only has this been fascinating, I think what I want to do is take everything that we talked about and probably pull some pieces out to mull over a little bit and talk to you again soon.
It sounds great, Jim. It's great talking to you. I'm looking forward to doing it again. But more importantly, I'm looking to kick your ass at Infineon Raceway on 250 Ninjas.
All right, fuck you.
Okay, there you go. Bring it.
There is a certain point where I would go, no. All right, Ed, thank you so much for joining us. And you can only push me so far, sir. At a certain point, I'm going to say, no, I still have a little bit of something left, and I will come out, and I will actually ride through the chatter or make you fix it for me.
No, I'll fix the chatter, and then we'll go racing. How's that?
All right, I'm down for it. Okay. And you know what? I should get out. I almost feel a little bit guilty for not coming out for the endurance race down at Button.
Yeah, World. April 23rd, right?
Yep.
Yeah, we're a weekend with California State Championship.
I know.
Yeah, it's a half hour, and I'm only riding with one team. So if you have a bike, I can ride with you the other half hour.
All right. Well, let me see if I can get my shit together. And otherwise, thank you a ton for joining us, and we will talk to you soon.
Thank you, Jim.
Cheers.
Aloha.
All right, folks, I hope you appreciated that. Super thanks to Ed. That was just a bunch of fun for me. And Jules, I know you haven't heard it yet, so once again, you get surprised much like I do with Martin. Being able to take that amount of time and actually talk about that kind of stuff is way cool. All over the map, kind of capturing a bit of AMA road racing history as well as the good old two-stroke days. Last of a breed, or one of the last of the breeds, and raced with some really cool people. Jules, let's fire into this whole thing about the badass article in Cycle News by Alan Cathcart.
So first of all, it's great to see that Cycle News is, you know, alive and well in the ether.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think everybody was very sad to see it go out of print. Anyway, so Alan Cathcart, as you mentioned, incisive writer.
Former racer,
yep. Wrote an article, which we'll have a link to, of course. You guys could read it in detail. I'm not going to belabor, you know, going through the entire thing. It's called The Story Behind the Story, The Pullout, which is about the Ducati leaving World Superbike for the 2011 season.
And this is the carry-on to the discussion that we had from last week with the listener email, too.
Yeah, exactly. To summarize, the article kind of – it doesn't really say it, but it almost – to me, it goes in the direction of hinting that Dorna is manipulating Ducati to basically take away the most recognizable marquee from World Superbikes in time for the 2012 season when they're going to be more production-like.
I don't know. It kind of says it.
Yeah, I know. He doesn't just say it in a compact little way.
Yeah, lots of implied, sure.
Right. And you know, the way he arrived at this was he actually kind of pieced this together just by saying, okay, this happened at this time, this happened at this point, this happened at this point, and this happened at this point. These are the people involved. You know, Ducati has had some interesting history, actually, throughout the last 20 years. You know, it was owned by a company in Texas for a while, and that kind of saved it from bankruptcy. And then since 2008, it has been owned by Performance Motorcycles, which is a front spearheaded by Invest Industrial Holdings, IIH, which is run by two brothers and their father, the Bonomis. And they are a firm that has lots of investments in Spain. And there's a tie-in there to Espoleta and Dorna. So we're already going, if you remember what the announcement came during the summer. The World Superbike factory effort was going to stop because, as they said, the results for 2010 were not very good, and that there was a lack of interest from the sponsors. Well, as it turns out, that was actually pretty much a bold-faced lie about the sponsor part, anyway. Because Xerox was totally willing to go into 2011 and sponsor the team, and they were offering, you know, money that could run a MotoGP team.
Just very briefly, I do want to mention this is one man's assertion.
Yes, that's correct. That's true. We were going off of this one article. I'm just describing the article, not the truth, yep. Right? But it's very interesting. Eventually, Xerox did pull out of the 2011 sponsorship when they found out that they were not allowed to call the team Ducati.
Mm-hmm.
It could be, yep. You know, Xerox Racing or something like that, but not Xerox Ducati. I've been thinking about this whole, there's just all this, all sorts of interesting data about Ducati. Ducati is recently was shown to be the second most recognizable placement brand, like, you know, in movies. Like when you see a motorcycle in a movie, what is it? It's always a freaking Ducati, right?
Or an Apple.
Well, yeah. I'm talking about motorcycles.
I know.
Do we have Apple motorcycles yet?
I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, pretty soon. They're extremely iconic. I mean, do you remember when you and Heidi were talking about Orchid, I started remembering that whole experience back in like 2003, 2004. And I started a Ducati group there, and it was huge, and nobody owned a Ducati.
Huh, really? You know?
Yeah, it was like just people who loved the brand.
I totally didn't know that you had a Ducati group on there.
Yeah, I mean, it was a pain in the ass to run because nobody knew what the hell. I would be like, hey, does anybody know like how to you know, tighten the belt on a 916? and people would be like, 916, beautiful bike.
Yeah, exactly. You know, I totally never asked you, and I'm going to completely diverge from what we were just talking about.
What's that?
Because we've already diverged. What did you think of that? Because the interview with Heidi.
That was great. I loved it. I loved hearing him. You know, I've talked to him before and real, you know, I mean, in real time.
But it was,
so I've heard it before, but it's just great. It was great.
It was kind of cool going back through the whole historical-ish bit.
I loved it. I absolutely loved it.
Okay. Carry on.
Okay. Anyway, it was around that time I started realizing just how the brand itself was so powerful. And that was years ago. And they've, you know, since then they've been in every freaking movie. The Hypermotard, it's any bike that Ducati, I guess they're gonna have to do something with the Diavel next,
Oh, come on! You know what? I actually saw a video for that where you've completely lost the plot. I saw a video for that, I think, on YouTube where there was some guy riding it in you know, typical canyons. It kind of looked like LA-ish, maybe, you know, up by the rock store or whatever. But the thing actually looked really freaking, you know, rideable in a canyon environment. And I'm like, you know what? That kind of makes sense because even if it was a quote-unquote cruiser, there's no way that Ducati's not going to give it a performance envelope that is familiar to your average aging Ducatisti.
Well, you know, I totally don't doubt that technically it's going to be a fantastic machine.
Yeah.
You know, it's just the ugliest thing I've ever seen in my life. But
no, but there's ugly.
But the thing is, you know what? As time goes by, like I'm amazed at how forward thinking they are. Because, like I told Martin a couple of weeks ago, I hated the Hypermoto when it came out. Now I own one and I love it.
Okay, and so you can look at another bike that a lot of people thought aesthetically was, you know,
the 999.
That aesthetically people thought was you know, baby puke, but is now an extremely popular bike, that being the S1000R from BMW.
Yes, that's true. That's true. I mean, I'm not sure if people are just not blown away by its performance more than anything else.
Well, there are certain things that can overcome.
The blue and white and black one is gorgeous. It always looked great.
Looked like a cop bike.
I guess so.
So are we completely out in left field now?
We are. We are. So like the inning's over. And anyway, so going back to this whole story, is the Ducati is in the perfect position to help, you know, manipulate some of these, you know, Machiavellian motions, because they're small. They're really small, right? They sell 30,000 bikes a year, or 36,000 bikes a year. That's so ridiculously small compared to Honda, Yamaha, all those guys. Those guys can't move around.
Yeah,
you know?
I got the sales figures the other day from in a press release, and I did that, and
it's actually hard to believe how small Ducati's.
So I started crunching numbers. And I'm like, damn. Well, you know, when you've got a relatively high retail price, but the thing that we kind of all forget is that for the most part, their race teams are paid for by their sponsors.
Marlboro is financing all of
nearly all of it, yeah. And to some degree, this would be a fallacy, but I won't say any race team is profitable. But I think they're doing pretty close to even. And if you think about it, it really is profitable because it's a company that is, you know, based on a racing heritage, despite the fact that Diavolo is. If there is ever a company that racing drives sales, it is Ducati.
And that's what makes them such a great brand to associate with a racing series.
And before anybody accuses me of becoming or of being a classic Ducatista, Jules, you can verify that I'm just a bike lover in general.
Oh, yeah. No, and frankly, like, this kind of stuff is kind of bums me out because I love the Ducati.
I love the Ducati motor.
Yeah. I love the twin, and
you'd hate to think that they were in some way kind of being bent.
It's Honda. It's like Honda in the early 2000s. You know,
we don't have the other side of the story, and there's usually at least four sides to a story, aren't there?
I'm not going to go and burn my Ducatis or anything
that. I'm sure you're not.
No, am I even going to get rid of them? I love them, but I'm just saying that, like, seeing that and seeing like the marketing side of Ducati, it gives me the creeps sometimes. It's like, you know, Harley Davidson.
You know, but here's the deal, dude. It's not just them. Every organization is going to use every bit of leverage, and
yeah, but you're not going to have a Yamaha Barbie.
You want
right?
to bet?
But you definitely will have a.
I think the absolute point is that to some degree, and probably the thing I took away most from that story, and it's absolutely true, was that Ducati was, without a shadow of a doubt, the iconic motorcycle that had been running in World Superbike for years and years and years. I think it was a bit that they were talking about.
I mean, sometimes to a bad effect because during certain years, you know, it was unfair.
During certain rules, the rules weren't bent in their favor either.
Yeah, that's right.
And not having them there is a shame. But in the end, what you could take away from that story is they are absolutely there. They just aren't there in factory colors.
Right, right. Well, that's the last thing that I was going to mention about the article is that, there's no official support, but Checa's got good parts.
That was the one place out of that article I went, okay, I was right. Yeah. From last week.
I didn't really do this justice. Go read the article. We've got the link in the show notes. Tell us what you think about it. It's a really fascinating read. If it was all fictional, it would still be a fun read. So
It does read like a bit of a spy novel in a way.
yeah.
You know, it totally does.
Exactly.
I loved reading it. It was, you know, what was that that book, Stealing Speed, that was out not so long ago? It kind of had the same tenor and tone to it to me when I was going through it. And they were both true. So, But very cool. Yeah. And I absolutely encourage you guys out there to go read it. It's certainly one to give you pause and one to make you think. And I'd love to hear your reactions, as you would as well, Jules. You can send them in to us in email or post them on the Facebook fan page or send us a hot air balloon with a little letter hanging from it.
Right.
I keep coming up in these weird.
Or a pigeon.
Or a pigeon. Well, no. They'll shit in.
Right. One last thing. Jim.
Oh, all right. You guys are going to hate me. Everybody, every one of you are going to hate me. we even Jules, you hated me even coming up with this, but I'm going to do it anyway. And this is slightly self-serving, and I'll say it right off the bat. This week's quiz for the God, it's March, so I better get that taken care of. And I actually got one of the calendars back in the mail. So, and I got that just today. I need to get in touch with that person because it was returned to sender.
Oh.
Here is the question for the final MotoMatters.com calendar in my possession. And this one is just plain evil. There's a whole bunch of people that subscribe to the Facebook fan page. It's well over 5,000 at this point. I think it's getting up close to
52,
the number,
53.
The number of feet in a mile.
Okay.
5,280. And of those people, what we're looking for are the top 10 countries represented by people that subscribe to the Facebook fan page. The person that comes closest, so you have to name 10 countries. The person comes the closest to having the most correct will win this MotoMatters.com calendar. Photos taken by Scott Jones, put out by Kropotkin, thinks better known as David Emmett. It's a fantastic calendar, and you want to get it before it's 2012. You will answer these questions. Send them in to us at a magical mystery email address that Jules will put in the show notes. Right, Jules?
I will.
And you'll make it short this time, okay?
Okay.
Okay.
Was it too long last time?
Oh. Dude, it had like dashes in it and like I think a couple of ampersands. wow. Okay. This is going to be a cool show. I actually can't wait to listen to it. And that's no bullshit. And I can't wait to hear your guys' reaction to it. I think you're really going to enjoy the Ed interview. As always, having Braxy on is just it's charming. In a, you know, classic sort of really gets it sort of way. Yeah. It's a pleasure to talk to you guys again.
Cool. All right. Oh, we almost forgot.
We forget.
Congratulations to Martin.
Holy shit.
Sharon.
Martin, Sharon, clink.
All right, everybody, take care. We'll talk to you next week.
Ciao. It's fun, isn't it?
I dare you to leave the fuck you part in.